You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Best of Flashpoints for the week of August 31st, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, Greg Palast returns with the latest installment of the Election Crimes Bulletin. Also, an interview with UFW President Arturo Rodriguez, who is stepping down at the end of this year after 25 years of successful leadership. Later in the show, we remember and celebrate Chicano Moratorium Day with Carlos Montes, founder of the Brown Berets. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Today we kick off the program with an interview from Thursday's show with Greg Palast, who returns with another installment of the Election Crimes Bulletin.
We're number one when it comes to guns and protecting elections, and I'll take that any day.
You're the guy behind the cross checklist.
So you will vote again, you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not for Chris Kobach.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we are delighted to welcome back to these airwaves Greg Palast. He is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. That first title is also a film, very important film, that deals with how your elections have been stolen in the past and how they're going to be stolen in the future. Greg has been a reporter for BBC for some time, now writing for Rolling Stone. Greg Palast, always good to have you on Flashpoints. There was an election last night. We've got a victory in Florida, a progressive Democrat. That's how he's being billed, Andrew Gilliam. He's going to be running. But does he have a chance in Florida? We're a little worried about if people's votes will be protected. We've had some problems there in the past.
Yes, and Gilliam, who is the black mayor of Tallahassee, only 39 years old, endorsed by Bernie Sanders, blew past a bunch of billionaires and the Graham family scion. Everyone's in shock. Except for the voters of Florida, of course. Now, here's the other shock, but you won't be shocked. The Republicans are using the same tricks that they used in 2000 to steal the election from Al Gore for George Bush. If for those of you who followed Greg Palast through the years, back in 2000, while with The Guardian and BBC, I uncovered that Catherine Harris, then the Secretary of State, Jeb Bush, I believe he was the brother of George Bush, ordered the removal of tens of thousands of voters from the voter rolls, saying that they were felons, not allowed to vote. In fact, I got a whole list. Not one of them was a felon. They were just mismatched with people that were felon, except almost all of them were African-Americans of the color blue, that is Democratic. Now, that's how they stole the presidency in 2000. And guess what? A Thomas Joseph Brown, who's an African-American attorney in Tallahassee, was removed from the voter rolls. Turns out he was removed because someone named Thomas Gerald Brown was convicted of a felony. They're playing the same game, Thomas Brown. Thomas Brown's all over the state, and Brown is a black name, are being removed under this phony felon fix in Florida. That's 2,000 reprieves, and there's no coverage of this stuff, by the way, in the Americano press. I mean, my research has had to dig this one up. So I'm going on. Looks like I'm going to be heading back down to Florida. This is like Groundhog Day, man, and they're just doing it again. And I'm getting tired of it. There's actually So that I wouldn't be bored, I actually turned The Theft of Florida into a cartoon, which if you go to gregpalace.com, you'll see the guy who did Who Framed Roger Rabbit turned that, The Theft of Florida, into a cartoon, the fake felon purge. But they're back at it.
Are you saying that the same structure is in place to have a repeat performance of 2000?
And please understand, the state has signed a consent decree in federal court saying they will never do this again. I mean, this is, you talk about recidivism, the felons are the government running right now, Florida, the Republican, the under Rick Scott and his new Catherine Harris. They're actually lawbreakers. They're felons removing people accused of felonies, but their only crime is voting while black. So we're back to Florida in the same old games. So I guess you know where Flashpoints and the Elections Crime Bulletin will be heading. At least I can bring my swim trunks.
Just make sure you've got some protection from the red tide. We don't want to think about that, though. Go on.
Okay. So the other is, and while I'm also hitting the road, I will be in Wichita on Friday evening, 8 p.m., showing the brand-new updated edition of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election, How Trump Stole It. And it's a twofer for me. I'm going to be not only working with the League of Women Voters and other groups and Women for Kansas, but I'll be taking the time to hunt for a guy named Chris Kobach, who I will be serving, if I can hunt him down, with a federal lawsuit. This guy is Trump's purging general. He's the guy that has set up all these purging programs involving literally millions of voters, mostly voters of color. We've talked about one of his cruelest systems called cross-check, doing pretty much what you just saw where we saw that Thomas Joseph Brown, the attorney, was mixed with Thomas Gerald Brown, the felon. Kobach, for example, has matched 538 guys named James Brown and said that they're voting in other states, that they're either voting twice or they moved to the other state. And the only, James Thomas Brown is supposed to be James Edward Brown. These are games being played. So what we're doing is
we should remind people he is now the official candidate on the Republican Party running for governor of Kansas. So he's
right.
Now
it's
using his technique at home.
And this is a very disturbing business in which, and we see this also in Georgia, where the GOP Secretary of State is purging the rolls like crazy of black voters. Chris Kobach is purging the voter rolls of, by the way, young voters. And both of these guys, so they're in charge of purging the voter rolls. They're in charge of where people get to vote. They've been closing voting stations. They're in charge of how the votes get counted. And they're in charge of it, and yet they are the candidates for governor. This is like if we saw Putin doing this, we'd be doing a rain dance. But in America, if a GOP official is bending the election in which they are running, that's, welcome to America, the new, the Trump's America. Now, I will be, and by the way, I want to welcome the listeners of KSUN and the Sunflower State in Kansas who've joined Flashpoints, and hope to see you all on Friday at the Orpheum Theater in Wichita, at 8 p.m. See you there. And hopefully I'll be seeing Chris Kobach there. I have invited him. The other two candidates for governor will be there. By the way, it's a dead heat between the Democrat and independent and Kobach as a Republican because he's hated by a large hunk of the Republican Party. So this will be interesting whether Kobach can erase enough voters, block enough voters, close enough voting stations to make himself governor.
Well, we're going to watch that very closely, and it's certainly something of grave concern as we head towards the major elections in November. We're going to watch all of this very closely. Florida, Kansas, lots of other places where you're going to be sort of moving forward with legal actions trying to restrain these guys. What exactly happens in Kansas? How do you go at Kobach there? How do you try and restrain him?
Well, what we're doing is hitting him first, because he's the center of the purging action, and 25 other, mostly GOP officials who've been cleansing the voter rolls using Kobach's cross-check system of saying people voted twice in two states. It's a list of 7 million people. We have a hunk of a list, but we want to get the names of the people he's actually purged, why he's purged them, how he's purged them, and get them back on the voter rolls. Okay, but first, the first thing we're doing in federal court is making him give up the list of the people he's removed from the voter rolls. We have his target list. He's been stonewalling us, but that's a violation of federal law. He has to give us these lists. And so it's a question now of me. If you've seen the film, you know that I have ways of hunting this guy down. He can run, but he can't hide. At a certain point, he's going to be served with this federal lawsuit. And then he's going to have to cough up the documents and reveal his secret files of the voters he's purged. Or he's already been cited twice and hit for 2 contempt charges by a federal judge. He's been ordered to go back to law school because he doesn't seem to understand the law. This is literally a federal judge ordering him back to law school. We are likely to have the same judge who is not going to take kindly, I don't think, to Kobach running a secret voter removal program.
Wow. All right. Again, you're listening to a special edition of Flashpoints. We're talking with Greg Palast. We have again started our election protection series. It's a crime bulletin, really, because your vote is being stolen across the country, and it will be stolen again. There's going to be a battle for the House, for the Senate, and then in 2020 for the presidency. And this is all a major problem in terms of protecting your vote. Greg, it seems everybody is concerned. The Democrat, everybody has sort of collaborated on this scheme that it is the Russians that we need to worry about. As long as we can make sure that the Russians aren't botting up our votes, we're going to be in good shape. But the real threat is at home, isn't it? It's not abroad.
I was laughing at this. I was asked on MSNBC, am I worried about the Russians hacking into the Ohio voter rolls? I said, I'm worried about the Republicans who have control of the Ohio voter rolls. They have the passwords. They have the entry points. And, for example, in this week in Georgia, and one of the other people we're suing is Jack Kemp, the Secretary of State of Georgia, running for governor against Stacey Abrams, the African-American woman running as the Democrat. His consultants suggested closing most of the polling stations in the black county, black majority county of Randolph County in Georgia. This is the type of game, and he didn't, I should have asked him, did you get this idea from the Russians? But I think not. I don't think you have to tell Jack Kemp, that the Russians can give any advice to Jack Kemp on how to bend the voter rolls. He removed, ready, 519,000 Georgians from the voter rolls in the last election cycle. Over 500,000. Once again, he's going to be served with a lawsuit after Kobach. I'm going to go to Atlanta and hunt down Mr. Kemp, serve him with his lawsuits. Now, he doesn't like it, but I have obtained his entire hit list of voters already. But now I need to see how many he's ultimately erased try to get them back on and prove. The Supreme Court had said he can do this. If he sends people a postcard, they don't return it. They're on his suspect list. You voted twice because your name's James Brown. I mean, every James Brown in Georgia. And if they don't return the cards, they can get removed from the voter rolls. Now, the thing is, it goes to people like named Brown and Rodriguez and Garcia, not to people named Koch or Kemp or Kobach. And that's the problem. It is violently racist, and we're going to try to stop him. Again, we'll be hitting him with a federal lawsuit because he has stonewalled me as well. Very few states have come across. They're all ducking, weaving, and hiding, but we're going to get the material. This is a long fight, and it's not just for 2018. Obviously, we can't save every vote by these midterms and by these gubernatorial races in Kansas, Florida, and Georgia. But our aim is to try to halt the vote thieving machine at least by 2020. And again, I haven't run into a Russian yet. The guys running around with these evil fake felon purge lists, fake double voter purge lists, and the rest, and the people closing the polls are good old boy American.
They don't speak Russian. Again, Greg, remind people you're going to be in Wichita tomorrow. You're going to be presenting the film again, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. A very powerful documentary, really. It's a film that nails down what Chris Kobach has been up to and really gives us a picture into the future if we're not careful and don't take control of the election. So, Wichita?
It's in Wichita at the Orpheum Theater, 8 p.m. I'll be there, and, of course, all the organizations that are part of Women for Kansas.
Okay, and again, Greg Palast can also be, his reports can be heard on the Best Democracy Money Can Buy. He reports for The Guardian. He's a BBC reporter for a long time. Before we let you go, we know you've done a good deal of reporting on NAFTA, and, you know, Trump is at it again. He's cutting a deal with Mexico. He's cutting a deal with Canada. Not sure what happened today, but it's in the news. What should we know about all that?
Well, we should know about that. Number one, the Democrats should stop moaning about Trump improving NAFTA. Because first of all, it is an improvement. Second of all, it isn't Trump, okay? And the media has been gassing on that somehow this is a Jared Kushner operation and Wilbur Ross and Trump and the corrupt president, outgoing president of Mexico, the lame duck, Peña Nieto. And they are not the people that improved NAFTA. It's a guy named AMLO, Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador, who was elected overwhelmingly. He's taken complete, on December 1st, he'll have complete control of the houses of Congress in Mexico, and the presidency won a landslide. He sent his negotiator into the NAFTA meetings and said, here's what we're going to do. And the number one thing he did, where the U.S. negotiators almost fell out of their chairs, he said, you've proposed changes to the auto industry. We accept it 100% starting now. Because what the U.S. had said, and didn't mean it, Wilbur Ross, who's Secretary of Commerce, who's in charge of these negotiations, said, you have to raise auto wages in Mexico to $16 an hour, which is 200 to 400% higher than they are now. You have to raise wages to $16 an hour, and you have to increase local content. That is, Mexican cars have to be made in Mexico to come to the U.S. You can't get cheapy cars from Brazil, put windshield wipers on them, and send them to the U.S. Lopez Obrador agreed to it on the spot, and they didn't want that to happen. And here's why. Because who owns those auto plants? Wilbur Ross, the U.S. Secretary of Commerce, the billionaire, owns 8 of the biggest auto parts plants in Mexico that make parts for the United States or go into cars for the United States. If Wilbur Ross wanted to double his workers' wages, he could have done it. They never meant this to happen. It was phony. Peña Nieto has always said no because his oligarchs didn't want to have labor being paid at that high rate. And so it is AMLO who pulled this off. Wow. All the removal of the disputes panels, all the positive things that have happened in this change, and they are positive. They will raise wages in Mexico. They'll raise wages in Canada and the United States. They'll protect jobs in all three nations. And that is completely, utterly the work of the Bernie Sanders of Mexico, a solid leftist, pro-working class man. And that's, he's been completely erased from the news in America.
It really is amazing. And, I mean, they tried to erase him several times. They undermined his – he should have been president quite a few years ago, and they were trying to force him out every way, which way. There was some serious voter fraud there. But he did make it in because there's such strong support for a candidate that's going to really represent the people
of
Mexico.
Well, it was amazing. He showed what you do if you don't gore out. That is – Al Gore, the election was stolen from him in Florida. We just talked about that. Kerry, the same thing. And by the way, Kerry did say he agreed with me that he was robbed out of the presidency in Ohio. Gore's never won't talk to me. But in 2006, AMLO, the Bernie Sanders of Mexico, who just was elected, when the election was stolen from him, he took 500,000 people into the central square in Mexico City, and for 6 months they occupied that. They had the people's inauguration. He refused to accept the legitimacy of the government which had stolen the election. And that created that created a sentiment among the Mexican people that, no, it's a if your vote doesn't count, then what you have is a dictatorship. And they rebelled this year against the dictatorship. And they say, why don't they steal again? Because you have – it's hard to imagine. We're looking at a true vote of roughly 80% for this guy. I mean, it was just absolutely unbelievable. It was such a crush, and it shows when you fight and you don't just – they can steal the vote when it's 2%, 3%, 5% difference. But when AMLO crushes them by 10%, 15%, and including in the Congress, even though they gunned down and murdered some of his candidates, you know, this the public had it. And that's what we can see here. And but so he's shown the way. But the first thing he did, he just shocked Wilbur Ross by saying, you want to raise your workers' wages in the auto industry? Done. Sign it.
Beautiful. All right. Let's leave it there for now, Greg. We will talk to you next week. I want to let people know that, again, you have written several incredible books, bestsellers, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Armed Madhouse. The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, the movie, is also available. It's going to be in Wichita. It's going to be in Kansas over the next couple of days. And
Friday.
We thank you. Friday.
Yep.
We thank you, Greg Palast. We'll talk to you next week. Be careful on the road there.
You got me. Thanks.
GregPalast.com, by the way. Check that out, too. May all be well.
We're number one when it comes to guns and protecting elections, and I'll take that any day.
You're the guy behind the cross checklist.
So you will vote again, you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not for Chris Kobach.
Número 8, inicie.
Listening to the best of Flashpoints for the week of August 31st, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature a pair of interviews from Wednesday's program. The first with UFW President Arturo Rodriguez, who is stepping down at the end of this year after 25 years of successful leadership. And after that, we remember and celebrate Chicano Moratorium Day with Carlos Montes, founder of the Brown Berets. Listen to this.
in Berkeley. I'm Dennis Bernstein. And again, we are proud to welcome, perhaps for the last time as the president of the United Farm Workers, Arturo Rodriguez. He is stepping down from that position after 25 years of doing a good job raising pay and making progress for farm workers who do some of the hardest work in this country, put beautiful food on our tables, and oftentimes don't get the remuneration they deserve. But Arturo Rodriguez has been at it 25 years and really over 40 years working with the farm workers, took over from Cesar Chavez. Arturo Rodriguez, welcome back to Flashpoints. It is so good of you to take the time out. Welcome. Could you just reflect a little bit about perhaps what were some of the most important struggles, the most important things that you were engaged in these last 25 years?
Sure, Dennis, but one thing I do want to clarify, Dennis, I'm going to stay on as president for the next several months until the end of December. So hopefully I am on Flashpoint before the end of the year.
All right. Again. Well, we'll do it again then.
There you go. But, you know, Dennis, we've been so blessed with the support of your listeners and with the farm worker leadership and the leadership that we have in the United Farm Workers today that, you know, we've been really successful, and that's why we feel comfortable doing this transition right now in many different areas. And one, for example, I mean, one that to me was so critical that we had that breakthrough for overtime for farm workers after 8 hours pay, because farm workers were discriminated against almost 80 years ago, Dennis. They were not given the same opportunity as all the rest of the workers in our nation, and that was a tremendous, tremendous oversight, but really a discriminatory act on the part of this nation to exclude farm workers from being the same, having the same rights as other workers in our country. So that was important, you know, in terms of making that happen. And, you know, and of course, preventing further heat deaths, that was of major importance to us. And by getting that legislation passed here in the state of California and now in Oregon and Washington that are thinking about the same thing. And in both cases now, we've introduced legislation on a national basis for overtime for farm workers, as well as for heat stress laws that protect farm workers during the hot seasons that we're seeing more and more today. And certainly those were very defining moments for us, as well as a real testament to the hard work and the leadership of the farm workers themselves and being willing to fight for these great victories.
Could you remind people a little bit of what it meant to you to inherit the legacy of somebody like Cesar Chavez, who is legendary in this country, one of the founders of the United Farm Workers?
Well, first of all, Dennis, to be very honest to you and to your listenership, I was scared. I was scared to no end because, one, we didn't anticipate Caesar's death. We hadn't prepared for it. And so to take over the directorship or the leadership of an organization that already back then, 25 years ago, had really developed a tremendous reputation among farm workers, among growers within the agricultural industry, that it was an overwhelming both opportunity and at the same time responsibility. But yet, you know, everybody stepped up to the plate. The worker leadership, our leadership within the organization, certainly Paul Chavez, who is the president of the Cesar Chavez Foundation, played a significant role in helping me bridge that gap from Caesar's leadership to the leadership that I began in regards to all the work that we'll be doing and so forth.
Another part of your legacy is passing the torch. I know I'm not trying to rush you out. You're going to be with us another couple of months in this position. But also there's an extraordinary person that's going to come in and take the place, and that's going to be history. You want to tell us a little bit about Teresa Romero and why you think she's going to be a good president?
Well, we're extremely fortunate to have someone like Teresa Romero, who's part of our leadership team. She's been so for the last 9 years. I've had the opportunity
to really work very closely with her over the course of these last 9 years that she's been with the organization full time. But Dennis, what's so remarkable is she's an immigrant just like so many of the workers that we represent and so many other immigrants that are out there, that when she came to this country, didn't know English at that particular time. She took on the responsibility not only of learning the language and learning the customs and the culture and everything else, but helping migrate the rest of her brothers and sisters, her parents, and so forth. And then she went on to work for and manage a law firm where they were out there helping immigrants in regards to issues around immigration and other issues of importance. And in addition, and then she went on to found her own construction company, which she was president of for almost two decades. So, I mean, those were important characteristics that we looked for when we were making the decision as an executive board as to who would be the next leader within the organization, who would take over that responsibility. And so we made a unanimous decision among our executive board that it would be Teresa. And everybody had their opportunity really to voice their opinions. And so we really, like I said, coalesced around what we felt that Teresa represented, being an immigrant Latina woman, and the importance of doing something of that nature to continue to demonstrate that the United Farm Workers will take the lead, will continue to be supportive and to work closely with immigrants in our country, and that because I am stepping down doesn't mean in any particular way our commitment wavers with bringing about immigration reform or bringing about a better life for immigrants in this country.
Well, and of course, it is a very good time. It's a very interesting time and a powerful moment to bring in the first Latina and first immigrant woman to become the president of a national union. This comes at a very special time, doesn't it, in the age of an administration that has demonstrated its disregard, its really hatred for brown and black people and anybody who is a shade darker than John Wayne. So this is a very special pick here, wouldn't you say?
You have a great choice. You have a great choice of words, Dennis.
Thank you.
You know, it is a critical time, really, to demonstrate that all of us are not wavering in our commitments, that we are solid and that we're going to continue to fight on behalf of immigrants and do whatever it takes and really make sure that they understand that, because most people don't appreciate the contribution that immigrant farm workers make to our nation. They don't understand that they're professionals. They're people with experience and know-how and knowledge to really do the hard work that it requires to harvest our fruits and vegetables and make sure that consumers are having a safe food supply. And so as a result, we want to do everything we can to highlight that, to emphasize that, to be committed to it. And in that particular way, we believe that we help secure the agricultural industry here in our nation. Because without immigrant farm workers, we don't have an agricultural industry, Dennis. So this is so important and so critical to make sure that we send that message loud and clear to everyone.
Does it make your job harder, or is there a different focus that you need to use when you have somebody who really is a demonstrated serial racist at in the position of president of the United States? Do you have to change? Does the routine change? Does the resistance change? How does one think about this in trying to deal with the Trump? Because I imagine this is part of the deal now.
You know, we have been out there. First of all, we have many different organizations that comprise our network of organizations that fighting on behalf of immigrants, one being United Farm Workers Foundation. And Diana Tellefson Torres has been our leader there in that particular organization. And so we have done, really stepped up in regards to our educational programs and the forums that we do and reaching out to immigrants, not only in this state, but also in the state of Arizona, and making sure that they know that they can come to us and get sound legal advice and ensure that we're going to do everything we possibly can to assist them. We now have, because of the work that Diana and her team have done, We now have, Dennis, the largest organization servicing immigrants in rural communities here throughout the state of California. So they literally see hundreds of people a day, and they're constantly figuring out and determining what is it that we can do and upgrading the skills of our people so that we can better serve the community. So that was a major shift in the work that we're doing, because we wanted to make sure we were out there, that immigrants knew where to come, that we continue to fight. And in addition to that, you know, legislatively, we are fighting against all the bad legislation that this administration is trying to pass, especially the legislation that was filed by Congressman Bob Goodlatte around the whole H-2A worker issue, where he is trying to strip away the protections that we have won for H-2A workers throughout the decades. And what he wants to do is pass legislation that, in effect, would lower the wages for immigrant farm workers in the state of Texas by $3.50 an hour.
Wow.
That would be devastating for them, and that would be devastating for agricultural workers across the nation if his legislation was successful. So we've found that, yes, we've had to ensure that we have a campaign of resistance to fight off bad legislation, certainly fight off the raids of ICE agents throughout rural California and other rural communities, and to do whatever it is that we can reassure immigrants, particularly immigrant farm workers, that we're not going anywhere. We're here to stay, and we will do whatever it takes to look for how to best protect them.
Was it important that California take the stand that it did in terms of a sanctuary? Is this an important part? In other words, having the people and the sort of the broader population behind understanding like the general reasons why it's important to have sanctuary and who needs to be protected. I'm wondering how the farm workers fit into that resistance.
Well, you know, we are very fortunate that we're in a state where we have a governor, where we have an attorney general, where we have a legislature that has not shied away from doing whatever they possibly can do to fight this administration and protect immigrant workers in our country. And we see the same thing on the behalf of so many different cities like Berkeley that have established themselves as sanctuary cities. We've seen people really step up to the plate in this time of crisis, in this time of racism and abuse and exploitation of immigrant workers, that people really have gone the extra, as they say, the extra mile to do whatever it takes. So that's important. And that's important that we set the example for the rest of the country and let people know that probably this is the largest, well, it's certainly the largest state of immigrant farm workers that are unfortunately without legal status. And we're into the hundreds of thousands in terms of immigrant workers that are here in all different types of industries. So it's important for our state to take the real leadership it has been.
All right. Well, Arturo Rodriguez, we thank you for joining us. We're glad that you're going to be with us in terms of being a president of the United Farm Workers for the next several months. We're looking forward to talking to you again and to meeting and talking with the next president, Teresa Romero. We wish you the best of luck in the rest of your tenure and all the things to come for you.
Yeah, and I'm very fortunate that we have a leadership team that has asked me to continue on, Dennis, as president emeritus. And I will continue over the next couple of years to work on strategic projects that we have and that we're engaged in, like immigration reform and collaborative relationships with different employers, as well as maintain some of the strategic relationships with retailers and politicians and so forth. So it gives me an opportunity to really do some other things that it makes it difficult when you're trying to run the everyday operation simultaneously.
Well, I hope you will come in and co-host in a collaboration here at Flashpoints, and we can do a couple of specials together. We'd love to have you here.
There you go. Look All forward right. to it. Just All please right. let us know, and we're ready to do everything. Thank All you again for what you do, Dennis. Thank you for all the work
Thank
that
you.
Y'all make happen in your audience.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, President Rodriguez. You take care now.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
For the last time as the president of the United Farm Workers, Arturo Rodriguez. He is... You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Now we remember some 48 years ago, the Chicano moratorium. Many people might not know what that is, what that stands for, what happened 48 years ago, but our next guest knows. His name is Carlos Montes. He was a leader in that student rebellion, that Chicano rebellion. He's a co-founder of the Brown Berets and an extraordinary player in fighting for the rights of Latino, Chicano folks all over this country. Carlos Montes, welcome back to Flashpoints and happy Chicano Moratorium Day.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here on August 29th, speaking to your audience out there. This is awesome.
All right. Well, the first thing I'd like you to do is just give us an overview, remind people what the Chicano moratorium was, and then I want to hear about your sort of run through the hallways, letting everybody know that it was liberation time.
Right. Well, you know what? The Chicano moratorium against the war in Vietnam was a massive demonstration held August 29, 1970, after two previous earlier marches, then maybe not as big, but this was a massive one. August 29, Chicano moratorium against the war in Vietnam to protest the U.S. involvement in the war in Vietnam, but also to denounce the high casualty rate of young Chicano soldiers in Vietnam, right? And these weren't just students marching down the streets of East L.A. These were working class families. We had everyone from the abuelitas to the young men and women marching together, saying, and stop the war in Vietnam, bring our troops home. And, you know, and some of the young men were even in support of the Vietnamese people fighting for liberation. You know, we had all viewpoints united to say, stop the war in Vietnam, bring our troops home.
Well, go on.
I was going to mention it was a massive march down East L.A. Whittier Boulevard. And then we had a massive rally at what they called Laguna Park back then. And we were brutally attacked by the combined forces of the LAPD and the LA Sheriff's Department in coordination with the FBI. We have files now that reveal that the FBI was aware of the march and was doing surveillance in coordination with the LAPD and the sheriffs. And we found out that they were in fear, meaning the Nixon FBI, a fear that the Chicanos and the blacks were going to unite with the massive anti-war movement. So they attacked us. They brutally attacked us, tear gassed us, beat us. And in the ensuing rebellion that the people were angry and rebelled back, throwing sticks and rocks, whatever we could find, at the police. Many police went down, by the way. You know, we went down, but many sheriffs went down with us. And unfortunately, during the rebellion, Ruben Salazar, who was a well-known L.A. Times writer, journalist, and director of the TV KMEX news station, was shot at Witter Boulevard, where he took refuge at the Silver Dollar Bar from the heat and the tear gas. He was shot by a tear gas missile projectile shot by the sheriffs, and it blasted his head open. He was killed. So to us, it's an assassination. He was targeted. He had already said, told his friend Philip Montes, that I fear for my life. I'm being followed. I'm being investigated. They already threatened to remove me and the sheriff. Excuse me, the pitches at the time, the LAPD chief asked them to stop reporting on the police brutality and the immigration abuse that was taking place. So to us, it's the historic Chicano Liberation Day. Thank you for honoring and hosting me tonight. Today, we celebrate it every day to say we're against all U.S. wars, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, and you know, U.S. interventions in Central America and Latin America. So thank you for hosting this show.
Well, we're glad to have you with us, Carlos Montes, and there's a lot more to talk about. I want to talk about a little bit more about Ruben Salazar, because he really was a revolutionary in terms of being a Latino journalist, the first columnist, I think, for the L.A. Times. He was high profile. Yes. He raised that issue to a very high profile in terms of Latinos, Chicanos dying at an accelerated rate in another country called Vietnam. Meanwhile, they didn't have rights at home. So that was an amazing thing that he was involved with. Now, you call it an assassination, and you mentioned that the FBI was involved. There were all kinds of intelligence agents all over the place. So it was very clear it was a murder at close range, and it was very clear that the powers that be knew who the murderer was, that this could have been a clear political assassination. Yes.
No, absolutely. I mean, they knew who he was. He was a well-known figure. He had all his credentials on him, and his reporter, Restrepo is the last name, when they attempted to get out of the bar, and they were pushed back by the sheriffs, right? And, you know, and they always have this excuse that a report of a man with a gun at the bar. So the sheriffs raid the place. Then they announce everybody out. When people try to get out, then they push them back in. But there's a picture that that Raul Reese took of Restrepo and Ruben trying to leave the bar and being pointed with a shotgun at chest level, them yelling them to get back inside. So they knew that was Ruben. He was well known. He is an amazing figure because he's originally from Juarez, Mexico. He worked for the El Paso Times, LA Times. And the LA Times sent him to the Dominican Republic, to Mexico. He was even in Vietnam and covered the, Cuba. So he was internationally known. And then they called him back. And at first he didn't like it, to LA to cover the growing Chicano liberation movement. And then when he got into it, he started covering the educational issues, the police brutality issues, immigration raids, and he even interviewed the Brown Berets, you know, and he interviewed us. He came to the East LA Free Clinic and interviewed us. You know, he wanted to know about the Brown Berets. He interviewed me. I met him. And this is, you know, and you're right. He was targeted because he took on a position with the KMEX TV station as director of news, which at that time was just about to grow tremendously. And he was covering all those critical issues of police killings, of racism in the school, the high casualty rate. And he was targeted by the LAPD and the FBI counterintelligence program that was already infiltrating the Chicano movement with undercover police in coordination with the FBI. We just recently received files through the Freedom of Information Act of the FBI spying on the Chicano movement even before the Chicano moratorium and even before the historic East LA walkout that happened in March of 68. They were already targeting the Brown Berets, Sal Castro, and many of the organizations. So, yes, he was a well-known figure.
And they knew who he was, and they knew he was there on the street reporting the rebellion and the Chicano moratorium, and they intentionally killed him to silence him.
Is the assassin still alive? Do we know who he is?
You know what?
A lot of people would know who committed this murder.
Right. You know what? I don't recall his name right now. You know, I'm getting a little old, my memory. But no, there was a coroner's inquest held, and he testified, the sheriff, that he was brought in. They showed him playing with the shotgun projectile, excuse me, the tear gas shotgun, and testifying. So we have his name and everything, and he retired from the sheriff, and I believe he's still out there. I'm sure we could Google his name and find out his name.
All right. But well, we don't even have to mention his name. We know
that this was
an assassination. They wanted to get rid of one of the most significant journalists of color and a pioneer. Again, as you say, first columnist for the L.A. Times. He was working in television then. He was really on the cutting edge, reporting. A human rights reporter. That's what you have to call him.
There you go. There you go. Absolutely.
Would you talk? We don't have a lot of time, but would you talk a little bit about the walkout? How the young people, how the students played a role? You were in the middle of that.
Yes, I was in the middle of it. As a Brown Beret, we actually planned, organized student strike committees at all the East LA high schools. And on March the 8th, the night before, we said, let's blast out. And our job was to run into the schools and start yelling, walk out.
Remind people who the Brown Berets were in this context.
Yeah, young, working, and I will say working class, not student. I was the only student. I was a part-time student at East LA College. The rest of them were just working or unemployed, angry working class youth. Brown Beret organization fighting for self-determination. And we had our 13-point program that called for self-determination, community control of the school, community control of the police. And we united with the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Movement to call for, self-determination for our people. And, of course, for unity with the Vietnamese people in Vietnam. We called for their victory against U.S. empire. And, one of the first things we did was take on the issue of police killings in East L.A. Then the other big campaign was demanding quality education because our schools were inferior, racist textbooks, overcrowded conditions, high dropout rate. And we, 50 years ago, March, now we blasted the schools wide open. And that was the first urban Chicano mass protest movement. And prior to that, it had been in the fields with the farm workers, Tierra Maria with New Mexico, the land struggle. But this was the first major urban uprising of Chicanos, and that precipitated massive marches all over the Southwest and a pivotal movement in the Chicano movement of the 60s, which we call the Chicano Power Decade.
Wow. In terms of that was really the backdrop for the modern Chicano movement, the Latino movement. Mm-hmm. It fed into the creation of the United Farm Workers, the resistance, and that grew out of that kind of action and the walkout that you helped lead, where young people began to take control of their own lives, walking out of school to have seminars in the streets and to learn more about the police and who was calling the shots. This was an amazing time.
Absolutely. And we were part of the revolutionary times of the 60s in the United States and worldwide. The Chicano power movement of the 60s and 70s, we took it a step further than the generation of the 40s and 50s. They wanted, assimilation, work within the system. And we said, no, we need to fight for self-determination, Chicano power, and support Black power and support working class power, right? And that developed a generation of activists that continue to be active even today. They're active in schools, as school leaders, as labor leaders, as activists. And, today we commemorate August 29 with a new generation of young activists that are hosting Raul Reese tonight in Ball Heights, who was the reporter who was there at the Silver Dollar outside when the sheriff raided the Silver Dollar and took photos of the sheriffs pointing their shotguns chest level at the occupants. I just wanted to mention that. Raul Reese is speaking tonight in Bull Heights. And he's also got a massive show of photographs in Southern California. You should all come down to the Gene Autry Museum of the Southwest. It's called La Raza. It's got 20,000 digitized photographs of that whole period, the walkouts, the Chicano moratorium.
And so what to us, it's
Chicano Liberation Day. I know many people know about Cinco de Mayo, right? But for us, August 29 is our Chicano Liberation Day, where we denounced, you know, U.S. Empire war against the Vietnamese people. And we said no U.S. wars. And we continue to demand that today, you know, regarding the U.S. interventions in Venezuela and in Colombia and in the Philippines and the key struggle of the Palestinian people in the Middle East.
Well, you know, just before we say goodbye, everybody is remembering John McCain today, somebody who was actually shot down in the middle of a plan to mass murder, to expand the mass murder of Vietnamese citizens, women and children and men. He's being celebrated. I'm wondering what you might want to say about that. And maybe how it might be a good idea to be celebrating Ruben Salazar, who was a real hero, a peacemaker, a visionary. You want to talk, take us out with that?
No, I think that's a good comparison. You know, Ruben Salazar, poor working class Mexicano from Mexico that came to the United States and started writing about the critical issues of education, about war and police killings. And he should be honored today. We are going to honor him today, August 29th, that he was killed by the sheriffs for doing the job of reporting the critical news and the critical civil rights issues. And, you know, compared to John McCain, who flew a jet fighter over agricultural country, bombing peasants and families. And now he's being honored. You know, it really gets me that once people die, they become heroes all of a sudden, whether it was Nixon, Reagan, now it's McCain. You know, the only thing that I remember he did, he voted against the Republicans, you know, on the when they wanted to abolish that Obamacare, right?
Right.
But his whole history, he was bombing Vietnamese people. He was a warmonger. He always voted in support for more military spending and more wars. He supported the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, every war.
Well, we are going to remember Ruben Salazar today. Thank you, Carlos Montes, thanks, founder of the Brown Berets, for helping us remember the significance of August 29th and the Chicano moratorium. We thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. And you know, solidarity to everyone up in Northern California and throughout the United States. It's a national show, so we got to continue the solidarity and demand, you know, peace and justice in this country and this world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carlos. Take care now.
And that does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Howard Zinn at his absolute finest. He discusses the futility of war, the necessity of disobedience, and the power of the people. I hope you'll stay tuned. Let me tell a little story from history, a story in which Howard Zinn played a part. It's mid-April 1945, and the war in Europe is pretty much over. The Germans still technically occupied France, but at least in the Bordeaux region, German troops were basically lying low and waiting for Germany's final surrender. The German and the Free French officers in the region had made their own armistice. If the Germans would not attack the port of Bordeaux, the French would not attack the German troops, as long as they behaved themselves. Germany's official surrender would come 3 weeks later. Then, on April 14, and again on the 15th, and again on the 16th, 1,200 American heavy bombers attacked Bordeaux's seaside resort town of Royan. The bombers flew at an altitude of 25,000 feet. Howard Zinn was a flight crew member on those raids, a bombardier. He recalled seeing the bombs fall and, many seconds later, the explosions. Over 3 days, the Air Corps destroyed Royan with 2,000-pound high-explosive bombs, with incendiary bombs, and with a new type of jellied gasoline bomb the Air Force was eager to try out. This was the first use in war of napalm. According to Bombardier Zinn, that raid had no clear military target. Even if there had been one, at an altitude nearly 5 miles high, the planes were incapable of hitting anything with any precision, not even with a much ballyhooed Norden bombsight. Well, the bombardier ought to know. After 3 days of carpet bombing, the town of Royan was totally destroyed. Almost every building was demolished. Possibly among the casualties were some German soldiers, who, you recall, were pretty much just holed up waiting for their country's final surrender. The overwhelming majority of the casualties were French civilians. You know, the people we were trying to liberate from the Nazis. In all, between 1,200 and 1,400 people were killed in that raid. Of the 1,200 bomber planes in the raid, only 5 were lost from all causes. For what purpose was this town obliterated? 20 years after the war, Zinn visited the Bordeaux region and researched French and American records of the Royan bombing. The French consistently described it as a tragic and terrible mistake. But the Americans justified the raid as protecting the port of Bordeaux. Studying the records, Zinn came to the conclusion that the raid had 2 real reasons. The first was crew morale. All those bomber pilots and crewmen were hanging around week after week with nothing left to bomb. Tempers were getting short. The men were getting itchy. Okay, let's give them something to bomb. Keep them busy and out of trouble. Give them another successful combat mission to put on their resumes. Here's the second real reason. The generals were real eager to try out these new 100-pound napalm bombs. They're supposed to be much better than regular incendiaries at burning people alive. The flaming jelly sticks to your skin. You can't get it off, and you can't put out the flame. This war is going to be over any day now, so if we want to test out this new stuff, we'd better do it soon. So we tried out the new napalm bombs, not on enemy troops, not even on innocent German civilians, but on innocent French civilians. The very people we were fighting to liberate from the yoke of Nazi oppression, as we like to say. Good news, the napalm worked beautifully. So much for the good war. Howard Zinn's good essay on Royan is in the anthology of his essays, The Zinn Reader. I recommend the whole book. In today's third and final installment of his 2008 talk, Zinn refers briefly to bombing a peaceful town of no strategic importance. That's Royan. He did it. Today, Zinn begins by talking about war in general, its insanity, and its counterproductiveness. Not just our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, all wars, including the alleged good war, World War II. Zinn's words that we'll hear today are the finest and most moving I have ever heard him speak. He speaks, well, of the futility of war. He also speaks of how disobedience is essential to democracy, and of how people have real power when they organize themselves into social movements. From November 2008, here is the late, great Howard Zinn.
I have to say something about war, a little more than I've said, because I've emphasized the importance of renouncing war and not being a war-making nation, and because it will not be enough to get us out of Iraq. One of these days we'll get out of Iraq. We have to get out of Iraq. We don't belong there, and we're going to have to get out of there. One sooner or later, we're going to have to get out of there. But we don't want to have to. We don't want to get out of Iraq and then have to get out of somewhere else. We don't have to get out of Iraq but keep troops in Afghanistan, as unfortunately, you know, Obama said, troops in Afghanistan. No. No more, not just Iraq. We have to get into a mindset about renouncing sort of war, period, and which is a big step. And my ideas about war, my thoughts about war, the conclusions that I've come to about war, they really come from two sources. One from my study of history. Of course, not everybody who studies history comes to the same conclusions. But, you know, you have to listen to various people who study history and decide what makes more sense, right? I've looked at various histories. I've concluded that my history makes more sense. I've always been an objective student of these things, yes. My ideas about war come from two sources. One of them is studying history, the history of wars, the history of governments, the history of empires. That history helps a lot in straightening out your thinking. And the other is my own experience in war. And, you know, I was in World War II. I was a Air Force bombardier. I dropped bombs on various cities in Europe. That doesn't make me an expert. Lots of people were in wars, and they all come out with different opinions. Well, so all I can do is give you my opinion. Based on my thinking, after having been in a war, I was an enthusiastic enlistee in the Air Force. I wanted to be in a war against fascism, the good war, right? But at the end of the war, as I looked around and surveyed the world and thought about what I had done and thought about and learned about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and learned about Dresden and learned about Hamburg and learned things I didn't even realize while I was bombing. Because when you're involved in a military operation, you don't think. You just, you know, you're an automaton, really. You may be a well-educated and technically competent automaton, but that's what you aren't really, you're not questioning. Not questioning why are they sending me to bomb this little town? The war is almost over. There's no reason for dropping bombs on several thousand people. No, you don't think. Well, I began to think after the war. I began to think that, and I was thinking now about the good war, the best war. And I was thinking, oh, and then I began to see, no, this good war is not simply good. This best of wars, no. And if it's true of this war, imagine what is true of all the other obviously ugly wars about which you can't even use the word good. And I began to realize certain things, that war corrupts everybody. Corrupts everybody who engages in it. You start off, they're the bad guys. You make an interesting psychological jump. The jump is this. Since they're the bad guys, you must be the good guys. No. They may very well be the bad guys. They may be fascists and dictators and bad, really bad guys. That doesn't mean you're good. You know? And when I began to look at it that way, I realized that wars are fought by evils on both sides. You know, one is a little more evil than the other. But even though you start in a war with sort of good intentions, we're going to defeat fascism, we're going to do this, you end up being corrupted. You end up being violent. You end up killing a lot of innocent people because you've decided from the beginning that you're right, and then you don't have to ask questions anymore. That's an interesting psychological thing, that trick that you play. Well, you start out, you make a decision at the very beginning. Decision is, they're wrong, I'm right. Once you have made that decision, you don't have to think anymore. Then anything you do goes. Anything you do is okay because you made the decision early on that they're bad, you're good. Then you can kill several hundred thousand people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Then you can kill 100,000 people in Dresden. It doesn't matter. You're not thinking about it. Yeah, war corrupts everybody who engages in it. What else can I say about war? Lots of things. You know, people will present you with humanitarian wars. Oh, this is for a good cause. The thing about wars is the outcome is unpredictable. The immediate thing you do is predictable. The immediate thing you do is horrible, because war is horrible. And if somebody promises you that, well, this is horrible, like, you know, we have to bomb these hundreds of thousands of people in Japan. This is horrible, but it's leading to a good thing. Truth is, you never know what this is leading to. You never know the outcome. You never know what the future is. You know that the present is evil, and you are asked to commit this evil for some possible future good. Doesn't make sense. Especially since if you look at the history of wars, you find out that those so-called future goods don't materialize. You know, the future good of World War II was, oh, now we're rid of fascism, now we're going to have a good world, a peaceful world. Now the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 50 million people died in World War II, but now it's going to be okay. Well, you've lived these years since World War II. Has it been okay? Can you say that those 50 million lives were, had to be done because of what? No, the wars, violence in general, is a quick fix. It may give you a feeling that you've accomplished something, but it's unpredictable in its ends. And because it's corrupting, the ends are usually bad. So, okay, I won't say anything more about war. Of course, it wastes people, it wastes wealth. It's an enormous, enormous waste. And so what is there to do? We need to educate ourselves and other people. We need to educate ourselves in history. History is very important. That's why I went into a little history, because if you don't know history, it's as if you were born yesterday. If you were born yesterday, then any leader can tell you anything. You have no way of checking up on it. History is very important. I don't mean formal history, what you learn in a classroom. No, the history that you learn, go to the library Go to the library and learn history. Yeah, we have an educational job to do with history. We have an educational job to do about our relationship to government, you know, and to realize that disobedience is essential to democracy. You see. Yeah. And it's important to understand democracy is not the three branches of government. It's not what they told us in junior high school. Oh, this is democracy. We have three branches of government, kiddos, the legislative, the executive, judicial. We have checks and balances. We balance one another out. If somebody does something bad, it will be checked by another. Wow, what a neat system. Nothing can go wrong. Well, those structures are not democracy. Democracy is the people. Democracy is social movements. That's what democracy is. And what history tells us is that when injustices have been remedied, they have not been remedied by the three branches of government. They've been remedied by great social movements, which then push and force and pressure and threaten the three branches of government until they finally do something. Really, that's democracy. Mm. We mustn't be pessimistic. We mustn't be cynical. We mustn't think we're powerless. We're not powerless. That's where history comes in. If you look at history, you see people felt powerless and felt powerless and felt powerless until they organized and they got together and they persisted and they didn't give up and they built social movements, whether it was the anti-slavery movement or the black movement of the 1960s or the anti-war movement in Vietnam or the women's movement. They started small and apparently helpless. They became powerful enough to have an effect on the nation and on national policy. But we're not powerless. We just have to be persistent and patient, not patient in the passive sense, but patient in the active sense, of having the kind of faith that if all of us do little things, well, if all of us do little things, at some point there will be a critical mass created. Those little things will add up. That's what has happened historically. People were disconsolate and people thought they couldn't, but they kept doing, and then something important happen. And I'll leave you with just one more thought. That if you do that, if you join some group, if you join whatever the group is, a group that's working on, you know, gender equality or racism or immigrant rights or the environment or the war, whatever group you join or whatever little action you take, you know, it will make you feel better. It will make you feel better. I'm not saying we should do all these things just to make ourselves feel better, but it's good to know that the life becomes more interesting and rewarding when you become involved with other people in some great social cause. Thank you.
Historian Howard Zinn, in one of his last major speeches in Binghamton, New York, November 8, 2008. We have time for a little bit of the Q&A that followed.
Question from the left and a question from the right. I like that.
Thank you, Professor Zinn, for joining us. I was really interested in your discussion of the word we and how it's kind of misused. But I was interested that you still kind of used it. I would tend to talk more in terms of, you know, they have built this empire and they are fighting this war and they never asked us, the real we, what we think. So I was hoping you could explain and make a little more explicit about why you choose to use the word we in the way that you do.
Well, I think I explained that, you know, we're so socialized and so polluted mentally that we keep using these words. We don't mean it. So, yes, even I, as smart as I am, find myself using the word we when I don't mean it, when I mean they. I should have a little signal that comes out from the ceiling that warns me that I'm about to use the word we when I should use the words that they. I mean, of course you're right. And I apologize profusely.
So all these questions seem somewhat related. So I was wondering, what do you think we should do with all this energy and this activism and this enthusiasm now if the Democrats, as you pointed out, continue to be to the right of the majority of the population? Do we continue to try to make them more progressive, or especially the young voters, abandon them completely, all our money, all our efforts, and go full force to a third party?
Well, I don't think in terms of parties. I think in terms of movements. So, no, I generally believe in, and I told this to Ralph Nader. I want you to know I'm on speaking terms with Ralph Nader. I said, the voting arena, the electoral arena, is not the arena for people like you and me. That's not it. And so I wouldn't try to divert people's energy to this party or that party. I think third parties play their role, as I just said. But that's not the important thing. The important thing, you know, is using this energy that you spoke of, this enthusiasm that you spoke of, to organize people in communities around the country. Look, that's what Martin Luther King was doing. You didn't see Martin Luther King running for office. You didn't see him playing an electoral role. You know, you see him mobilizing people. Before his death, you see him walking with the strikers in Memphis. You see him planning, you know, this tent city across the Potomac, a poor people's campaign. You see him engaging in direct action. That's what you see. And that really is the important thing. And I do believe that thinking about parties, whether it's Democrat or third party, is very much a diversion, you know. Yeah. The electoral system is overplayed and overpraised and saps a lot of energy that could go into community organizing. Well, okay, let's...
But I'm wondering what your personal... I know Noam Chomsky is a proclaimed anarchist. I'm wondering what your personal opinion is of anarchy as an ideology.
Well... trying to get me into trouble. You probably may know that one of my great heroes is Emma Goldman, you know, the great feminist anarchist. You know, very often people try to categorize me, you know. They approach you and say, what are you? They want a one-word answer. It's like, you know, the true-false tests that you get in school. What are you? I say, well, actually, I'm not sure. I'm a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Are you a Marxist? Are you an anarchist? Are you a socialist? Are you a communist? Are you a liberal? Well, I'm something of a Marxist. I'm something of an anarchist. I'm something of a socialist. Not really a liberal. In the New Yorker a few issues ago, there was some letters. They printed some of the letters of Norman Mailer, who, you know, died not recently. And he was writing a letter to Playboy magazine, which had interviewed him. And Playboy magazine referred to Norman Mailer as a liberal. And he wrote to them, he said, please. He said, you can call me anything you want. You can call me a socialist. You can call me an anarchist. You can call me a Bolshevik. You can call me an outcast and... an outlaw. You can call me anything, but don't call me a liberal. Anyway, okay, who's next? Oh, wait, no, I didn't really answer that question, did I? I didn't answer that question. I'm sorry. If you simply say, oh, I believe in anarchism, well, people will, you know, shudder. Because, you know, there are misconceptions about anarchism, saying, oh, anarchists, they're violent bomb throwers. No. No, governments are violent bomb throwers. You know, there have been some anarchists in history who have been bomb throwers. There also have been Democrats who have been bomb throwers, Republicans who have been bomb throwers. Governments have been the biggest bomb throwers. But actually, most anarchists have been rather nonviolent. You know, Tolstoy, I'm going to say Tolstoy and Thoreau and Gandhi. And so there's a misconception about anarchists being violent people. Or anarchists don't believe in my kind of anarchist doesn't believe in violence or bomb throwing or anything like that. The other misconception is that anarchists believe in disorder. No rules, no regulations, do what you want. Smoke while not wearing a seatbelt. You know. Anarchists just don't believe in centralized government. They don't believe in centralized power, the centralized power of government or the centralized power of the church or the centralized power in the economy. They believe in the kind of loose conglomeration of collectives in the society with real democracy, not the democracy that comes through voting, but the democracy that comes through people getting together, you know, all over and making decisions by themselves. And there are little examples of that in history. Read the history of the Paris Commune of 1871. Read the history in George Orwell's book, Homage to Catalonia, about when the anarchists took over in early 1936, Catalonia, Barcelona. And you see, an order not enforced by punishment, an order that comes out of people's cooperation. Amazing how that can work.
The late historian Howard Zinn. He died a little more than a year after these words were spoken. For the original 90-minute recording, our thanks to Lynn Gurry, longtime producer and host of the Unwelcome Guests radio program. And I am Kenneth Doust, longtime producer and host of New World Notes. In any case, from Darkest Connecticut, I thank you for listening. You can find more of us on our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. As Zinn reminds us, disobedience is essential to democracy. The people are not powerless, and, if I may slip in one of my own, what have you got to lose by tuning in again next week? Till then. Thank you.
And we're back, and it is the Taylor Report, and it is CIUT 89.5 FM, and we're very proud to be talking today with the former Prime Minister of Rwanda, Faustin Twagirimungu. Prime Minister Twagirimungu, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Taylor.
We're very glad to be talking to you today because there's a week or two ago now, Kofi Annan, who had been for many years was the Secretary General of the United Nations, he had a significant role to play in the crisis and tragedy and ugliness that happened in Rwanda in the years 1990 to 1994, but very particularly in the year 1994. And you lived through that as a political leader and then later as the Prime Minister. And I know that, and I want our listeners to know, that you do have a Twitter account, and I urge people, Faustin Twagirimungu, go to that, because you have been following things closely, I note. And you had some thoughts, questions about, at the time of his death, I think you noted that he must have had he had a lot of information, and I guess we could use the word secrets, that he did not share. So that was my starting point. What are your thoughts about the role of Kofi Annan in the matter of Rwanda?
Well, Kofi Annan, in the first place, I think I have to explain to your listeners that Mr. Kofi Annan is an African. The entire world expected of him to be having a knowledge, an entire knowledge, of what is the African continent and what would be the result to decisions he would probably have wished to take as far as Rwanda was concerned. Mm-hmm. He did not do that. From 1990, when RPF, it means Rwandan Patriotic Front, attacked my country in September, October 1st, 1990, we started with a lot of political problems of killing people in different areas. People were killed by the RPF, mm-hmm. until such a period that we decided that we have to negotiate with the attackers. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, on the 6th of April, 1994, mm-hmm. the president of Rwanda was killed. At that time, Mr. Kofi Annan was deputy secretary general of the United Nations in charge of peacekeeping forces worldwide. So, of course, he has also been in a position to send I will call them blue helmet to Rwanda. And unfortunately, in 1994, at that particular date of the 6th of April 1994, two presidents were assassinated by RPF.
Yes.
The president of Rwanda and the president of Burundi. Instead of, to make sure that the situation does not become a chaos, they rather favor the RPF to continue killing my compatriot, mm-hmm. the Rwandan citizen. And Mr. Kofi Annan failed to influence the United Nations, and particularly the Security Council, to increase the peacekeeping forces to prevent the genocide from taking place. Instead, they withdrew the soldiers who were in Rwanda. The United Nations soldiers. They were authorized to leave Rwanda and maintain the situation of chaos, which led us to the genocide, mm-hmm. being Rwandan genocide indeed, because all Rwandan Hutus and Tutsis were killed. That's one. Mm-hmm. Second, in 1997, you have to remember that Mr. Kofi Annan was elected as a Secretary General of the UN. And in 1997, RPF attacked the refugees in Congo. And they went on killing refugees until even they reached Kinshasa, the capital of Congo, where they have established their own government. Mr. Kabarebe, who is today the Minister of Defense in Rwanda, became Chief of Staff of the Congolese Army. Just imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, he failed to prevent the genocide in Rwanda or to influence the United Nations to stop the genocide in Rwanda. And he influenced the killing of refugees in the Congo bushes and the forest and the kind of tropical bush until Kagame managed to take the Congo country as his own property.
Mm-hmm.
So, therefore, I cannot, frankly, in my own position today, as a former Prime Minister of Rwanda, a witness of what has happened in my country, tell to the world that Mr. Kofi Annan has rendered or has given or tried to influence the United Nations to find a solution to what has happened in Central Africa, meaning Congo, Rwanda, and particularly other countries surrounding Rwanda, like Burundi.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, I think that he failed, and there's no way I can pretend to appreciate the job he has done. And then it is not only that. You also have to remember that in 1995, you know, there has been a genocide in a place called Kibeho. Kibeho is in the southern part of Rwanda. This was on 21st of April, 1995. RPF killed more than 80,000 displaced people who came from the north of Rwanda and they were put in a camp near the border of Burundi in the southern part of Rwanda. And Kagame decided to simply go into that camp and kill people to make them free. He killed more than 80,000.
Yes,
I was there.
Yeah, I want to mention
it's incredible that the decision taken by the United Nations while Mr. Kofi Annan was also peacekeeping forces was to simply keep silence. No condemnation whatsoever of these killings. Let me finish this.
Sure.
I know, and you know too, that in Srebrenica, Srebrenica was in, let me call, where Mr. Milosevic was president.
Yes, of Yugoslavia, yes.
You remember what is the country? In any case, 6,000 Muslims were killed there by the troops by the troops of Milosevic. The United Nations decided to call it a genocide. The United Nations refused to call genocide 8,000 refugees killed in the southern part of Rwanda by RPF army under the order of Mr. Kagame. And Mr. Kofi Annan did not say anything at all. You know, Mr. Boutros also had his own problems. The Americans did not like him. They used to call him French. And he was replaced in 2001 by Mr. Kofi Annan. So it went on and on and on until people were killed in Congo. It went on until Mr. Kagame simply organized his power in Rwanda while he was kind of a chosen leader of the whole part of Central Africa. trying to go to Burundi to kill people, killing people in Congo, what they call the Democratic Republic of Congo, and of course keeping on killing people in Rwanda, assassinated some leaders like Mr. Sendashonga and many others in our country. And we were afraid to leave the government and to settle now in Belgium, you know. So the silence and the complicity of the United Nations through Mr. Kofi Annan is real. I don't invent anything. Yeah. I think I have to stop here.
We're speaking to the former Prime Minister of Rwanda, Faustin Twagirimungu, and you noted the date. Your dear colleague, Mr. Sendashonga, it was his voice and yours who began to speak to the power of the army, and it led to his assassination in Kenya, and you yourself had to leave the country for fear of your life. Am I right?
Of course, yes. Of course, yes. And unfortunately, I will have to tell to your listeners who was Mr. Sendashonga. Mr. Sendashonga was formerly Minister of Interior, starting from 1994, just after genocide. We were in the government together. From the 17th of July until both of us resigned on the 28th of August 1995. So he went back to Kenya where he was working before, and he was assassinated there on 18th, 1998.
Yes,
but before he had been attacked by the assassins.
That's right. People forget they'd actually already wounded him previous.
Yes, previously, yes. And
and Colonel Azindi had been murdered.
Yes, yes, yes. I think you are very well informed, yes. So just imagine. And yet nothing has happened. There's no investigation about his death, but everybody will tell you he was killed by Kagame. Yes, Kagame was killing other people too. You know, he killed Patrick Kashigeya in South Africa. He tried to kill Mr. Faustin Nyamwasa. He's trying to kill other people in Rwanda. He tried to kill me here in Belgium. He tried to kill other people abroad. Mm-hmm. But what is astonishing, it's surprising us. The international community, so-called international community, I'm very sorry to say that.
Yes.
Has simply tried to convince the entire world that Mr. Kagame is the best world leader. I mean, one of the worst world leader, if not the best African leader, to keep in power.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care about crimes he has committed. Until, I have to underline this, to make Rwanda peacefully, they pretended to create an international tribunal,
mm-hmm.
which had the mission to judge all people involved in the genocide in Rwanda, Hutu and Tutsis.
Mm-hmm.
Only Hutus were tried by that tribunal. No member, no one soldier, no one political leader coming from RPF was tried by that tribunal. Just imagine.
Yes.
One way, not both ways, of justice. And Mr. Kofi Annan, when this tribunal was set up, was there. When he was elected Secretary General, he was there. When this decision of trying both sides was taken, he was there. He did not say anything. And I have to add this. I don't have to forget it. It was just 1994 in September. Mr. Kofi Annan came to my office. I was prime minister then. He said, you know, There's a gentleman called Gersoni has made a report. I just come here to beg you not to accept that report. I asked why. No, I simply ask you, don't listen to him, because that report did have, they don't, does not have to be published. I told him that I have already met Mr. Gersoni, who came to my office, and he told me that about 3,000 to about 40,000 people were killed by RPF in the eastern part of Rwanda, a place called Kibungo, and the surrounding areas.
Mm-hmm.
So I was frankly surprised to the advice given to me by Mr. Kofi Annan. And indeed, it ended up by simply stopping the report. This report was not published. As many other reports on the killing of RPF in Rwanda was not published. As the assassination of President Habyarimana, no investigation
None.
Has been made by United Nations. But remember, Mr. Aril was the first the prime minister, I think, in Lebanon. When
Hariri,
Mr. Aril
yes.
was killed, mm-hmm. the international community was moved. And the United Nations took immediately the decision of making an investigation. But in my country, or in our region, two presidents have been assassinated by RPF.
Yes.
We know that. RPF knows it. And Kagame confirmed once on Hard Talk BBC interview that he has killed Habyarimana before Habyarimana killed him.
Yes, he said, he's my enemy. I don't care.
Has been made.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine the situation in which we are today?
Yes.
A killer is in power. A killer is sanctified by the international community, mm-hmm. being appreciated as the best leader in the region.
By Blair, you know, and Clinton.
Having a lot of prizes, being invited to the most important universities in the USA, Yale University, Harvard University,
yes.
and many others. And, of course, being entertained by some important Jewish organizations in New York, as if the man is a saint.
Mm-hmm.
The man is a killer, and the man has to be punished, and he has to be investigated.
Yes.
That is my own conclusion.
Well, and as many join you. And by the way, we have to – and I want to mention an author. I know you appreciate the book, the recent book written by Judy Rever, the because she's a Montreal-based author. She worked for the French press for many years. She experienced the refugee crisis in Tingi Tingi with mainly Hutu refugees there who died in the thousands. Now, she's written a remarkable book. I'd like to know your thoughts about that book.
Well, this book has been the best book I have ever read about what happened in this area, I mean in the region, and particularly what happened in Rwanda. Some writers have been trying to do better than her, but they could not. I think she's the best. We have investigated a young lady, went to this tropical forest, he followed the refugees, he investigated in Rwanda, he investigated in different countries where refugees were living, and he made a tremendous job. And his book, frankly, let me tell you that I haven't read any book who can tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So he revealed the untold story about what happened in Rwanda. But unfortunately, today, I haven't seen any reaction to what she has said, what she has written, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There are other writers, French mainly, like Mr. Payan. Mr. Payan has not been in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
He's the other one who told the truth about RPF.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, his government did not react. Other international organizations, did not react. And no matter what will happen, the truth has been told, and nothing can tell that truth better than Judy ever. This is what I say.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and I, she documented with very close research and interviews with people whom she produces with names, et cetera, who saw the killings in the Akagera, and she dealt with all the myths and legends. It's absolutely brilliant. I agree with you, Judy Rainver. I hope people get the book. And now there's another detail I want to make sure I ask you about. A gentleman that you met, Mr. Philip Gurevich of the New Yorker magazine, who in my view has done a lot of harm because he's a great admirer of Paul Kagame and wrote books, a book largely lionizing him. He tells a story of the famous genocide facts. Actually, I should tell our listeners that the top of the facts sent by General Dallaire in January 1994 says a request to for assistance in removing an informant from Rwanda, something which was totally impossible, totally outside his parameters of responsibility, et cetera. But at any rate, that fax is used as supposedly the indicator of what happened 6 months later, 3 months later. In telling the story, it begins with you because he says, Gurevich says that a very important person, he uses the letters VIP and he's quoting Dallaire, had come to Dallaire to say that there's an informant and that he should he'll tell the story of what's going on. In my view, Gurevich is confusing people because my understanding is that you did not meet this so-called informant and neither did General Dallaire. Can you talk about the whole matter?
Well, I don't know what expression I would use in English because I will simply say that Mr. Gurevich is not honest because he knows once that he met me in the office. I told him the whole story. He did not mention anything in his book. It's the first book he published.
Mm-hmm.
Second, I did not meet that gentleman who pretended that he has told the real story about what happened to our country.
Mm-hmm.
What has been told to Mr. Dallaire by the gentleman I indicated to him,
mm-hmm,
has been put in the report, I think Mr. Dallaire, I mean, he sent to the United Nations. Here also I have to be precise. Mr. Dallaire did not really told me how the report, what was the content of the report. I don't remember, and I have not forgotten anything. It is true. Mr. Dallaire never show me or give me a copy confidentially of what he has sent to the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, we have discovered that the so-called informer was simply a gentleman from RPF because his brother was once been a kind of mayor in Kigali after the so-called liberation of Rwanda by RPF.
Mm-hmm.
So this was an invented story. It was untrue. And Mr. Gurevich was to use it to convince the international community, all the world, that his first book was correct. Probably was correct to some issues, but his book was read just after the genocide, and everybody jumped to that book to think that what he's telling in it was true. Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I have answered your question quite clearly,
mm-hmm,
but I have not met the informer, and all the informer had given to Mr. Dallaire. But Dallaire himself discovered that the guns were not to make. They were insufficient to pretend to prepare genocide.
Yes.
Let me just stop here. In some cases, remembering them, they make me kind of frustrated, and I don't know what to tell.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, by the way, everyone knows that it's in Amadou Dem, the captain who did actually meet him, said that the kinds of arms they were talking about was rather common throughout the city of Kigali, which people were being assassinated. And I believe you have addressed that as well, that the RPF at that time, between January and April, were assassinating people in the city of Kigali.
Yeah, they assassinated people, including some politicians. And we were, you know, confused. We certainly must have said that they were assassinated by the Habyarimana regime. No, they were assassinated by RPF. I can give an example. Example of Mr. Gapisi, who was assassinated in 1993 by RPF. It is confirmed now. And the assassination of the Minister of Public Works, Mr. Katabazi, was assassinated by RPF. Mm-hmm. And many other people were assassinated by RPF.
Yes, and all parties were worried about their own security, of their people being safe when they traveled about, for fear of having that happen to them.
Yes, because the RPF seems to have been allowed to be free, you know, leaving the CND places, as we call it, where we have accepted that a battalion stayed in Kigali, RPF battalion stayed in Kigali. So they took civilians, clothes, they traveled all over Rwanda, killing people and putting them on the opposition, or pretend that they have been killed by President Habyarimana. Let me mention this. It is very curious that UNAMIR was there to ensure security, and I don't see any security ensured by UNAMIR. I'm very sorry to say that, because police and some army officers were prevented to work freely with their arms, light arms. But the RPF was allowed to have their arms and going around killing Rwandans. So it is a pity. The situation we were in, it was really abnormal. While we were under the umbrella of the United Nations, we did not know that all those crimes could be committed until our president is assassinated and until the time of the genocide broke out. It's a very sad story. As Rwandans, we have suffered a lot, and we continue to suffer by keeping such kind of killer man, a killer personality as leader of our country.
Yes.
We have no consolation at all, particularly in a very simple analysis of what has happened. The entire world will simply say Tutsi genocide took place in Rwanda, as if they have not been Hutus who were killed. While the international tribunal, which would have clarify the situation, kept silence as far as Hutu were concerned, and tried to please RPF and to offer RPF a kind of world authority as far as the Rwandan situation is concerned. That is it's just incredible. So we shall continue our fight to tell the truth. Also thank all foreigners, particularly young people like Judy River, who tried to clarify the situation. And we believe that in the future, those who are going to read what has happened in Rwanda will be astonished how our people have been betrayed by the international community, including one of the African highest diplomat and decision maker like Mr. Kofi Annan, who, unfortunately, I have to repeat, were chosen to be a prize Nobel winner. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. So I can't tell all what I have in my heart, mm-hmm. but I think I have said what I could tell you by answering your question.
Yeah. Well, certainly, Mr. Prime Minister, you've done that, and we are very, very grateful. And I'm very glad you have a Twitter account. I find it extremely interesting. I urge people to follow you. And thank you very, very much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tiller.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Supporting immigrant labor, fighting for their rights.
Whether immigrant workers, documented or undocumented, seek to hold crooked and exploitative bosses accountable for wage theft and pay that is below the prevailing wage, or work just too many hours for too little pay and benefits, and are subject to abusive treatment to their personage, such as sexual harassment, or want the freedom to push for decent jobs and organize unions without risking arrest, they deserve legal protections. Now, with Trump threatening to bring a reign of lawlessness to American cities, the most precarious workers are subjected to more militarized and extensive workplace raids, mass arrests, family separation, and expedited deportations. Then there is the all-too-familiar story of scapegoating immigrant workers and deliberately pitting them against American workers as big corporations cut wages as they seek to reap bigger benefits. They replace one set of workers with another from other regions to other countries, or by automating work. Meanwhile, CEO pay and bonuses continue to rise while workers' wages fall. When you're scrambling to find work or getting beat out of a job by someone willing to work for less, there's an allure to an anti-immigrant stance, but taking that bait doesn't get us very far. The issue may not come up in contract talks, but a safe, fair workplace, regardless of immigration status, is key to social inclusion, promoting economic fairness, and helping communities exercise the rights they do have, especially those without a say in who gets elected to office.
Migrants seeking asylum and immigrant workers aren't pulling the strings of a rigged economy. Those making the decisions that cause economic hardship can be more likely found at Mar-a-Lago, not at the border. If we don't focus on holding the ultra-rich and greedy corporations accountable, workers will continue losing. All the raids in the world will not help native-born and documented workers with job security. This false notion that we are in competition with immigrants limits our inability to see each other, even when the collateral damages children. At this moment, wealthy corporations and billionaires, not immigrant children and their parents, are sacrificing workers for profits. We should see this as a warning. When people are so dehumanized that forcing kids to sleep in kennels becomes acceptable, the value of life for everybody goes down. Instead of scapegoating children, mothers, and fathers, we should reconnect with our humanity and demand change from the true source of our hardship, an out-of-control corporate class. Let's be clear. We have found the culprit, and it's not our fellow workers, and certainly not children.
Ken and I felt the need to say this. We've been long overdue in suggesting what our thoughts are on the horrifying attacks on immigrant sisters and brothers, immigrant workers. And with that, two of the people who work arduously, who labor in the field in support of workers, the working class of immigrant workers, are Pablo Alvarado, Executive Director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, and Kent Wong, Director of the UCLA Labor Center and Director of the UCLA Labor Center and founding President of the Asia Pacific American Labor Alliance. And I thank you both so much for joining us. And why don't we begin with Kent Wong, and maybe you can give us the lay of the land now, if you will, on what immigrant, undocumented workers in particular, are facing.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show and for highlighting this critical issue. There are currently 11 million undocumented immigrants living within the United States. They play a critical role in many parts of our economy. They plant and pick the fruits and vegetables that we eat every day. They care for our young, for our elderly. They are an indispensable part of many manufacturing and service industries throughout the country. But because of their status as undocumented immigrants, they are subject to extreme abuse and exploitation. Many people talk about how our immigration system is broken. Well, in fact, it's working for those who are reaping the benefits of exploiting immigrant workers, and it's also working for those who are trying to use this as an issue to divide workers along their common interests. And so what we see today is that there is amazing organizing that's taking place among immigrant workers all across the country. Some of the very strongest union organizing campaigns and worker center organizing campaigns are being led by immigrant workers in spite of these very harsh conditions. But they cannot win this fight alone, and it's really critical that other people in the community, in unions, in faith organizations stand up to speak out and defend the rights of immigrant workers.
Pablo Alvarado, Executive Director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, which is one of the groups. So why don't we ask you, who are the workers that you represent, what do they do, and what are the obstacles that they face, both in terms of the employers and in terms of the government and ICE?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. Well, you know, the day laborers are people who defy the odds every single day, and they offer the only thing that they possess, that is their labor, and they do it, you know, standing on sidewalks, defying police officers, security guards, unscrupulous employers, white supremacist organizations, and individuals that come in and harass them every single day. And despite all of these obstacles that they face, every day they're there waiting for an employer who's willing to offer them a day, a day of work. And they are ready to do whatever job is available to them. When the day laborers are not organized, when they haven't come together to decide what their minimum wage is going to be, when they are isolated from each other, that's when unscrupulous employers come in and take advantage of their circumstances. And they oftentimes hired for 1, 2, 3 days, oftentimes weeks, and then with a promise that the employer will pay perhaps at the end of the month, and the employer at the end of the month will come and tell them, hey, wait for me here on Saturday, I'm going to bring you a check, I'm going to bring you pay at this time, and they never showed up. So these are some of the abuses that that workers go through. And at the workplace, when people get to the workplace, and there are a lot of health and safety risks that people face, and most employers fail to provide, even though under the law the employers are supposed to provide, the personal protective equipment gear, and that doesn't happen. So workers are, forced to work under very dangerous conditions. These are some of the abuses, but also while folks are waiting in the streets they face violence. I mean, they face persecution by, as I said, local police officers. In terms of the immigration debate and in terms of immigration law, the federal government has the exclusive authority to enforce immigration law, but in the last decade, that authority has been transferred to some police departments. In some places, in a limited way, but in some other places, in a full-blown participation of local law enforcement in immigration law enforcement. So you would see oftentimes police officers coming and interrogating workers about their documents. And again, I mean, that adds to the uncertainty that people live every single day. Yeah. So none of that, but again, I mean, the system might not work for workers, but it does work for the unscrupulous employers. It does work for the abusive people. It does work for the corporations, because they have a cadre of workers who are marginalizing, who are willing to do whatever they are asked to do without any protection, and some of the employers and corporations take advantage of that situation. Except that when workers are organized, that doesn't happen as much as it does when they're not. So fortunately, across the country, there are at least 70 day labor worker centers and more worker centers that are, assisting workers in recovering unpaid wages, training people on health and safety, ensuring that when employers fail to pay their wages, that there is a way to recover those wages. So there is a significant segment of organizers, labor organizers and worker leaders across the country who understand that their rights, that no one is going to come and give them their rights. They have to organize and demand them.
I want to bring Kent Wong back into the discussion. And we opened up with a rather long statement that Ken and I had jointly authored. And one of my concerns still is about the greater working class, if you will, and the way they are so easily maneuvered and manipulated to vie away from the people who are really the oppressors, whether it's the individual bosses or whether it's a larger systemic grouping, the plutocrats that are taking back the hard-fought-for wages and benefits and rights of unions and so on. And Kent, what do you begin to do, or how do you, in your understanding and work as the director of a labor center, as somebody who works with the AFL-CIO, as somebody who does represent the Asia-Pacific American Labor Alliance workers, et cetera, how do you begin to really break through the white workers, and it's certainly, I think, of all classes, and begin to create that knowledge that it is who is really in their interest or whom it is really in their interest to align with versus really falling prey to the demagogic rants and rhetoric of the Trumpians that use xenophobia to divide the working class and tap into a base for themselves. I mean, that's a hard thing.
Sure, you pointed to a critical issue. And throughout history, we have seen how corporations and employers have used divide and conquer tactics to keep workers divided, whether it is based on race, gender, or immigration status. And if you really look at how Trump came to power, in large part, it was by fanning the flames of racism, of sexism, of anti-immigrant hysteria, and promoting a lot of fear of the other. And his whole call to build a wall, his inhumane separation of children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border, his call to eliminate deferred action for childhood arrivals for 800,000 immigrant youth, his elimination of temporary protective status for immigrants and refugees from Haiti, from El Salvador, from Honduras. These are all very calculated steps to drive divisions and to blame the economic problems that workers face throughout this country on immigrants. They're the ones causing the problem, according to the administration. They're the ones who are causing unemployment and poverty, when in reality we see a horrendous imbalance of wealth and power in this country. We see the 1% in this country have amassed more wealth and power than at any time in U.S. history. And so it's very important that we break down these lies and the xenophobia and the anti-immigrant hysteria through direct action, through bringing workers together and showing the power of collective action when workers stand together and fight together. I think there's a great example here in California where we have one of the most powerful union organizing campaigns involving the Justice for Janitors, who went out and then organized the predominantly African-American security officers here in California. And so you see this multiracial unity that pushed back against worker exploitation and abuse and saw the benefits. We've had other examples across the country where white workers have stood with immigrant workers and defended their rights. And so I think that this is a really critical time to expose the lies and hypocrisy of the current administration and the anti-immigrant rhetoric, and to find creative ways of building multiracial organizing campaigns that represent the interests of workers.
Pablo, you and the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, as I speak, are on a journey for justice for the TPS workers, for the migrant workers, for the refugees who are in this country who Trump wants to eliminate asylum. Tell us about that issue and why you're in solidarity, and when you're going to be in New York.
Well, look, I mean, I think Kent is right that, I mean, there's a tradition in this country of blaming workers of color oftentimes, and there's a tradition of even unions sabotaging the participation of workers of color in their ranks, and so you will see that. And the legacy of white supremacy has taught, in a very false way, many Americans to believe that the rights of U.S. workers are in tension with the rights of foreign-born workers. You know, that in order to make the lives of U.S.-born workers better, that you have to make the lives of immigrant workers miserable. So that's the kind of like the, you know, the legacy that it's been widespread, and the TPS, that taking away that temporary protective status has been motivated by that it's undocumented workers, migrant workers, that drive down wages and working conditions, when that is not the case. It's actually the employer that takes advantage of people's circumstances. So that's a reality that people face. So TPS holders are within are the victims of those attacks, and the president decided, motivated by politics, by ideology, to eliminate the temporary protective status of over 460,000 families. Essentially, these are folks that have dedicated a significant number of them, like, for example, the Salvadorans or Hondurans. They came to this country when they were 20, 22, 18, so they have dedicated the best years of their lives in their jobs. These are workers who are qualified. As a matter of fact, 90% of them are employed. These are people who, by any stretch of the imagination, have been incorporated themselves into the labor market in the United States. I mean, these folks, they have jobs. They own homes. 30% of them own homes. They have about 275,000 U.S. citizen children, and some of them have had the temporary protected status for over two decades. They have grown roots in this country, and nonetheless, they are, living in multiple dimensions of uncertainty right now.
They don't know what's going to happen with their lives. So people are thinking about what's going to happen with my kids, what's going to happen with my job, what's going to happen with my property. And they are, you know, like every day that goes by is one day less that they have with their documents. We're not talking about undocumented people. We're talking about people who have had documents, who have done everything that they have been asked to do. And nonetheless, their status has been terminated. And again, it's because of these political and ideological motivations that Mr. Trump has. You know, they simply don't want to see, essentially, immigrants of color. Because for this administration, immigrants from Norway and Europe and Canada are okay, except people from the South. You know, so it's very clear to us. And it's important that unions, that the working class in this country sees TPS holders as workers. Because before being TPS holders, before being immigrants, people are workers, and they have workers' rights as well.
We are going to get back to when folks are coming to New York, but I want to just move back for a second to ask Ken Wong some of his thoughts on this, and of course Pablo as well. As recently as Wednesday, there were a number of raids in 13 different locations that we know of that were conducted by ICE officials, served warrants on 13 different locations, 11 in Nebraska, for example, and arrested roughly 130 people. Now, the raids come, of course, as President Trump's administration has been carrying out ever more high-profile enforcement actions against employers who hire undocumented workers. Your thoughts on what can be done about that, or do you know of, Kent Wong, actions that are being taken by organized groups of laborers in conjunction with community to stop these ever more militarized and aggressive raids on people who are trying to survive and maintain their families?
ICE is playing a horrible role in many communities throughout the country in terrorizing immigrants, in raiding workplaces where we have immigrants who are contributing to our economy, who are working, who are helping to produce the wealth in this country. And yet, in a very calculated political move, the current administration is going after workplaces to wreak havoc within these communities, to strip families from their parents, from the wage earners in their families, and to plunge immigrant families further into poverty. So these raids are doing nothing to improve the lives of anyone. They're doing nothing to improve our economy, but they're a way of targeting immigrants and stirring up more division and fear. What I see happening throughout the country is that there is tremendous outrage, and there's a new sanctuary movement that many faith communities are embracing. There are people all across the country who are expressing outrage at families being torn apart at the border and children being held in cages. When the administration tried to implement their Muslim ban, we had thousands of people rallying to airports across the country, expressing their support for Muslims who are being unfairly targeted. So the reality is that the vast majority of people in this country do not support the current administration's vicious attacks on immigrants, and it's important at this critical time to stand with immigrant families, to stand with immigrant youth, and to push back at these very racially motivated and politically motivated attacks.
Is there actually any specific legislation? We don't have that much. We have a minute or two left that is being proposed. And then, of course, Pablo Alvarado, we want to find out when you folks are coming to New York so that we can build support.
Unfortunately, given the current political climate in Congress, no progressive immigration legislation has a chance of moving forward. The November midterm elections are critical. It's very important that people get out to the polls and that we can hopefully unseat the Republican majorities in the House and Congress, because they are a major obstacle in any hope of passing progressive immigration reform.
Pablo Alvarado, when are we going to see you folks in New York? I know there's something planned. Tell us about that.
Yes. These are TPS holders.
They're
some
TPS
of them are
holders.
Day laborers. Some of them are day laborers. Some of them are construction workers. There is even members of La Yuna in the bus. There are members of HGRE. There are union members and members of worker centers, day laborers, domestic workers. So TPS holders work in all the different industries that you can think of, including the field. So there's a bunch of, there's a group of about 20 TPS holders who are in the bus, going from city to city, telling their stories, putting a human face to the separation of families. And they're telling America that if the separation of 2,300 kids at the U.S.-Mexico border created such a humanitarian and moral crisis for the country, just imagine what would happen when their TPS status ends. And 275,000 kids are separated from their moms and dads. That's what they're telling the country. They're also telling the country that for over 20 years they've paid taxes, they've done everything that they've been asked to, and that they should be in a path to citizenship, not in a path to deportation. And the third thing, that which is very important, is that obviously this administration's intention is to disseminate fear across the board. They want to make sure that immigrants fear government, police institutions, etc. And they want also Americans to fear immigrants. So it's essentially an agenda of fear that this administration is spreading. So they understand that the only folks that can actually remove that fear is actually the impacted communities themselves. So they're going through out the
country. We have about 10 more seconds, please.
They're telling people there's no reason for you to fear immigrants. So that's why people should support this Journey for Justice, which will be in New York on September 17th.
And we'll give you more information as we get closer to the 17th. And we want to support and say thank you to Pablo Alvarado, Executive Director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, and Kent Wong, Director of the UCLA Labor Center and Founding President of the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance, and to all of you who understand that we must fight against xenophobia and support all workers and our documented and undocumented immigrant workers. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
The library is for everyone, not just for people who don't like drag queens.
They show up and they have their way with your children in demon outfits.
The two main characters, Alice, also known as Al, and Juliana, a famous singer whose career Al is managing, are also lovers.
Oh, Marosa, you're the worst, but damn, I'm glad you came.
All across America, something is stirring.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Australia's PM Polka imperils equality prospects, kids check out diversity from library drag queens, and humor in history soothes Trump distress disorder. Those stories and more this week because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 25th, 2018. Australia has its sixth new prime minister in 11 years, and it marks a rightward shift for the already conservative government coalition led by the Liberal Party. Scott Morrison was promoted from treasurer to prime minister by his party on August 24th to replace Malcolm Turnbull, who consistently caught flak from some Liberal MPs for his more moderate positions on social issues. He saw the writing on the wall and stepped aside earlier in the day. Even more hardline right-wing lawmaker Peter Dutton had originally challenged Turnbull's leadership, but Morrison was seen as a more palatable choice in the narrow 45-40 party room vote. He's a Pentecostal Christian who strongly opposed marriage equality and favors religious liberty measures that would allow discrimination against LGBTQ people. During a brief stint as Home Affairs Minister, Morrison took harsh measures to prevent asylum seekers from living in the country, including a partnered gay Pakistani man. Unlike many other Western democracies, Australian voters elect a political party rather than the party's candidate for prime minister. This allows the ruling party to change prime ministers in mid-term. Both parties have virtually admitted in recent years to changing prime ministers because of falling poll numbers ahead of a national election, and this week's shift was no exception. No sitting Australian prime minister of either major party has finished a full term in office since 2007. And as the expression goes, down under, many Australians who are required by law to vote have had a gutful complaining about a governing political party virtually nullifying their votes before the term ends for the person they think they elected. Some have taken to social media to lampoon the situation. As the Associated Press reported, one set up a tongue-in-cheek Twitter account that names Australia's prime minister with hourly updates. A popular meme circulated purporting to be a public service announcement. Remember Australia. Change of prime minister means change your smoke alarm battery.
This is Barry Mackay in Sydney. Prime Minister Scott Morrison is not predicted to last very long in office. There is talk of the Parliament holding a no-confidence vote in the government in 2 weeks' time when Parliament sits again. If that passes, then there will be an election in October, and it's very likely that the Conservative Liberal Party will get voted out. Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is resigning from Parliament, and there will be a by-election in his electorate. Former Prime Minister Tony Abbott's lesbian sister Christine Forster may stand as the Liberal Party candidate in Malcolm Turnbull's former electorate. However, if the Liberal Party fails to hold the seat, they lose their one-seat majority in Parliament, and the government again could be at risk of holding onto power if they do not get support from the crossbenchers. If all goes well, then the next federal election has to happen by May next year. The general feeling is that as the Australian public is sick of a constant revolving door of prime ministers and disunity in the Liberal Party, that the Labor Party are likely to take power again. Labor Party leader Bill Shorten was very vocal in his support for marriage equality during the campaigning last year. This is Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia, for This Way Out.
Life for LGBTQ people in Malaysia has gotten even worse than we've previously reported. There was a first-ever raid on a venerable gay nightclub this week, and and the sentencing of two women to potential jail time and canings under Islamic law after they were caught having sex in a parked car. Same-gender sex is a criminal offense in mostly Muslim Malaysia, but each state can also punish Muslims for violations of Islamic law. Equality advocates had hoped that the recent defeat of the rabidly anti-LGBTQ ruling party would mean at least a less vocally anti-queer government. But Malaysia's new deputy health minister has said that LGBTQ people suffer from an organic disorder. The deputy prime minister opposes the idea of recognizing a transgender identity because it would cause chaos in society and has urged all LGBTQ people to stay in the closet. On August 18th, police raided Blue Boy, a nightclub in the nation's capital of Kuala Lumpur that's long been popular with LGBTQ patrons. Officials had for some 30 years largely allowed the club to operate in peace. Local Islamic authorities ordered the 20 men caught up in the raid to undergo counseling for their illicit behavior. And Human Rights Watch this week called for Malaysian authorities to stop the canings of those two women in the northeastern state of Terengganu, calling it the latest blow to Malaysia's LGBT community, which had hoped for better protection under the country's new government.
Some 400 people have reportedly volunteered for so-called gay cure therapy at an anti-queer conference in Ghana called Exploring the Myths Surrounding LGBT Rights. The event, to be held at an undisclosed location in the Northwest African country, is being organized by the National Coalition for Proper Human Sexual Rights and Family Values. Its leader, Moses Fo'amoning, also announced plans to open a holistic sexual therapy unit at a teaching hospital in the capital city, Accra, which, according to the state-owned newspaper, The Daily Graphic, will also attempt to cure queer people of their sexual orientation. Gay sex is currently punishable in Ghana by 3 years in prison. However, Fo'amoning wants to make cure therapy a mandatory part of the sentencing. "We will make our punishment corrective," he said, "instead of punitive." The moves come on the heels of an announcement by Ghana President Nana Akufo-Addo that the government has no authority to overturn anti-queer sex laws, and we will not seek any authority to do so. Speaker of Parliament Aaron Mike Okoye said he would rather resign than allow discussion of pro-LGBTQ legislation. Some see the latest wave of homophobia as a backlash to calls by British Prime Minister Theresa May at a Commonwealth Nations conference earlier this year for member states with laws against same-gender sex to consider repeal. Fo'amoning claims that it was part of a secret Western plan to reduce the continent's population. Ghana is among 37 of the Commonwealth's 53 member nations to still criminalize LGBTQ people.
According to court documents released on August 24th, a lesbian is suing the Hong Kong government for denying her the right to enter into a civil partnership with her female partner. The woman, known only as MK, filed the unprecedented lawsuit in June, but details of the case only emerged during a preliminary hearing at the High Court late this week. Her attorney, Eng Jing Bond, said during a 30-minute hearing that denying the woman's request was unconstitutional and violated the city's basic law and Bill of Rights. "We want legal status for everyone," Eng said, "regardless of their sexual orientation." Hong Kong lawyers said they needed input from all 13 government departments before they could respond. The South China Morning Post reported that Justice Anderson Chow Ka-ming agreed to the extension, saying he expected the case to be heard during the first half of next year. Hong Kong, while part of China, is considered to be a special administrative region of the People's Republic and, as such, enjoys a relative degree of autonomy. The city's only openly gay lawmaker, Raymond Chan Chi-chuen, called the lawsuit a direct challenge to the whole system. The government has no way to escape from studying all levels of policies dealing with same-gender couples in the process, he said. But Michael Vidler, who's litigated other queer rights cases in Hong Kong, worries that the lawsuit may be premature and that successes by same-gender couples in Europe and the Americas might not necessarily work in Asia. "If this challenge fails," he said, "it would set a bad precedent that will take many, many years to overcome."
And finally, a controversial LGBTQ museum in Brazil that was forced to close following an online petition by anti-queer conservatives has defiantly relocated and reopened to record crowds. The Queer Museo debuted in the southern city of Porto Alegre a year ago and was the first major exhibition dedicated to LGBTQ subject matter in the country. Conservatives accused organizers of promoting pedophilia, bestiality, and blasphemy. Its grand reopening at the private Parque Lagos School of Visual Arts in Rio de Janeiro on August 18th drew unexpectedly large crowds. The exhibition runs for 1 month and features 223 works by 83 artists from around the world. The country's biggest crowdfunding campaign raised some 1 million reals, about $275,000, to cover relocation and related costs. The exhibition is free to the public. Curator Guadencio Fidelis told Agence France-Presse that he's hired 20 security guards and installed extra security cameras to protect people from right-wing protesters. "It is a very important moment for Brazilian democracy," he said, "a convincing demonstration that the most progressive sectors of society will not accept censorship." Fabio Schwarzwald, the visual arts school director, said the exhibition has set a new attendance record. More than 8,000 people came to see the show on its first weekend.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending August 25th, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the new and improved thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
That's O-M-A-R-O-S-A.
Be very afraid. But first,
I wonder
who wrote the Book of Law?
It's who reads the book that's the issue in Lafayette, Louisiana, and Mobile, Alabama, where drag queen story hour events are being planned at local public libraries. The programs, geared for 3 to 8-year-olds, feature men in drag reading approved picture books and leading other activities. They're intended to teach individuality, diversity, and acceptance. Lafayette Mayor Joel Robideau says he wants to find a way to get the event canceled, but the library is legally beyond the reach of city government. Drag Queen Story Hour supporters turned out en masse for the August 21st Lafayette City Parish Council meeting, but the mayor left the meeting rather than hear the arguments of citizens like Rhonda Kim Gleason.
The origin of the term drag is uncertain. The first recorded use of the term is in reference to actors dressed in women's clothing from 1870. This is not a new phenomenon, and drag is a theatrical form. As a theater nerd who has been very active in the community theater community here in Lafayette for several years, I am friends with lots of people that do drag, whether they be gay or straight, and that doesn't matter. When they go on stage, they are in that persona. And when they get off stage, they are not in that persona. They are not out to corrupt children or indoctrinate them or any of that. The library is for everyone, not just for people who don't like drag queens.
Conservative pastors and the Alabama Tea Party are making a stand against an upcoming Drag Queen Story Hour in Mobile. Although the programs have the backing of the National Association for Library Service to Children, protests are spreading across the country with the help of always subtle InfoWars host Alex Jones.
They dress up like space aliens all over the United States and all over the world. I told you, in horrible demon psychopath outfits that make Pennywise look beautiful. And they show up and they have their way with your children in demon outfits. I mean, if you've got men that look like 400-pound goblin demons with your children, there's nothing you all put up with. There isn't a species on the planet that would let something that looks like a space alien get up close to its kids. But only in America does it happen, and I'm sick of it. I'm tired of it right now.
I realize that I'm not the likeliest candidate for this office. I don't fit the typical pedigree.
Unlikely once, but not at all outlandish by today's standards. Comforting memories later in the program. Two Americans head for Paris in 1955, and This Way Out queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason is thrilled to make the trip with them and their creator, Vanda.
When I heard that the lesbian writer Vanda had a new book out, book 3 of her Juliana series, I was very excited. You see, I love historic novels, and when a historic novel is written by a lesbian and includes lesbian characters, that makes me very happy. Paris Adrift is the title of Vanda's newest novel, published by Sans Merci Press. And it may be written as a third book in a series, but it can also be read on its own. At the same time, there are allusions to previous circumstances that were in the early novels, and that the reader of the entire series will get. The two main characters, Alice, also known as Al, and Juliana, a famous singer whose career Al is managing, are also lovers. They are from New York City, and when the novel opens in 1955, they are taking an ocean liner to Paris, where Juliana is booked to sing in nightclubs. The tenor of the times, so real that Al and Juliana experience blackmail, reveal to the reader that intense homophobia is as alive and well in Paris as it is in New York. Vanda writes a passage from the point of view of Al that sadly echoes sentiments that I have heard in the not-so-distant past. Of course, Max would have no choice but to fire me. I'd lose all my clients who'd want to be represented by a mentally disturbed, potentially criminal, a natural woman, a thing. I'd lose my gay clients, too, like Marty. It would be too dangerous for him to be represented by me. I'd never work again. At least not in show business or government or civil service. Is there anything left? I'd be poor again, maybe scrapping by in low-level jobs like my father. I'd hate that. I did have savings and stocks, so I could hang on for a while. But my work in cabaret? I must have that. It was my life. Still, I survive it, somehow. But Juliana? She was used to being adored. If it came out that she was... The worst for me would be that this would most likely be the end of us, and that I didn't know how I would live through. The novel takes the reader through history, a factually accurate history, that provides her plenty of interesting asides and insights. But ultimately, it is a love story between these two women, Al and Juliana, and is a tale of how their lesbian love, which must remain hidden, is able to survive. As Vanda writes, "Oh, there have been a few women like us who lived in Paris somewhat openly, women artists who were already considered odd, like Gertrude Stein, Alice B. Toklas. They weren't really accepted by most, merely tolerated. Many others who came here to write or to be artists kept their relationship secret. No, I don't think we'll ever be treated like everybody else. Then let's stay here all day and pretend the rest of the world doesn't exist. She kissed me and we made love again. Everything would have been perfect, except." There has been much written about the importance of telling our stories. For me, as a member of the lesbian community, as someone who recognizes that our stories are so often marginalized and dismissed, the importance of telling our story, especially in a historic novel in a lesbian context, is proof that we do exist and, in fact, have always existed. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, Noah in the Noah's Ark movie and TV series, and you've discovered This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Who are you betting on to stop the Trump administration carnage? Special Counsel Robert Mueller? The U.S. Congress? Porn star Stormy Daniels? Internet sensation comedian Randy Rainbow knows who his money's on.
Welcome back. We are joined now by a woman who scares the living shit out of me, former White House aide, reality TV villain, and author of the new book Unhinged, Omarosa Manigault Newman. Omarosa, what a pleasure it is to have you here.
I'm just not buying that.
Well, you got me there. You have been on a media blitz promoting your book and dropping secret recordings that you made during your time in the White House.
This is just the beginning of the type of corruption that's going on in Trump world, and I am here to blow...
Excuse me. I'll do the blowing around here. Now, you've brought with you today a new recording. This is an exclusive, so let's go ahead and have a listen. We warn you that what you're about to hear is extremely stupid.
Hey, lowlife, it's me. Listen, I had no idea they were going to fire you after I told them to. I'm absolutely sick about it. Don't love it at all, but what I really wouldn't love is you flapping your yap all over town about all the crazy shit I say and do. So listen, I'd like to offer you $15,000 a month to shut the hell up and occasionally pick up my dry cleaning. Cool? Thanks, dog.
Okay. What the hell was that?
I saw this as an attempt to buy my silence, to censor me, and to pay me off $15,000 per month.
You say that there are more tapes, even video. You also allege that there is recorded evidence of the president using horrific racial slurs.
Absolutely.
How do you respond, Omarosa, to the questions about your own credibility?
I have been able to verify every single thing that I put in the book, and every single time the Trump people challenge me, I bring the receipts.
We've never paid attention to a word you've said. All that pompous highfalutin gobbledygook. Thought when you got fired, your career was dead. Now you're peddling a goddamn book.
A brand new book, and guess who's really shook?
He says that you're a fraud, which is ironic, cause he made ya. You say that they hushed you with donations that they paid ya. I think that we may have hit an all-time low. Now our precious country's a reality show. Though you're just a thirsty-ass publicity whore, could you be the hero we've been waiting for?
I am not going anywhere. Donald Trump has met his match.
Marosa, you're the worst, but damn, I'm glad you came. Will your sour grapes and secret tapes finally kick his ass at his own game?
It's the art of the deal.
Marosa, you're a mess, but I'm not mad you're here.
Oh,
if you crush this clown, I'll clean your crown when they make you Woman of the Year.
Oh, Marosa, we know that you're ratchet and mean, but we're ready to make you our queen.
Yes, queen, and when we say,
fine,
we'll buy your book today. We only hope that your player takes Omarosa, Omarosa, press play.
If I need to, I'll do what I have to do to protect myself.
Oh, Marosa, God, you suck, but go and make that coin.
Make that money, honey.
Honey, open up a secret club for your fans, and maybe I will join. I said maybe. Oh, my God, I hate you, Omarosa Manigault.
You're a monster.
But your ass I'll kiss, cause now he's pissing his pants and saying, oi, go fall.
He isn't Jewish, but okay.
Though you might be a fraud, every night till I pray to the Lord. That if you heard him saying the N-word, you taped it and that you'll play the tape. Omarosa, Omarosa, that's O-M-A-R-O-S-A.
Believe me, my tapes are much better than theirs.
Omarosa.
Donald Trump has met his match. I am not going anywhere. This is just the beginning.
Brandy Rainbow is a total loser. Believe me.
Randy Rainbow's videos are tearing up on YouTube, but you can also find him at randyrainbow.com. Not all that long ago, that fanfare did not set off alarms about what rights might be next on the chopping block. Just a decade ago this week in Denver, Colorado, Senator Barack Obama accepted the Democratic Party's presidential nomination.
America, our work will not be easy. The challenges we face require tough choices. And Democrats, as well as Republicans, will need to cast off the worn-out ideas and politics of the past. For part of what has been lost these past 8 years can't just be measured by lost wages or bigger trade deficits. What has also been lost is our sense of common purpose. And that's what we have to restore. We may not agree on abortion, but surely we can agree on reducing the number of unwanted pregnancies in this country. The reality of gun ownership may be different for hunters in rural Ohio than they are for those plagued by gang violence in Cleveland, but don't tell me we can't uphold the Second Amendment while keeping AK-47s out of the hands of criminals. I know there are differences on same-sex marriage, but surely we can agree that our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters deserve to visit the person they love in a hospital and to live lives free of discrimination. You know, passions may fly on immigration, but I don't know anyone who benefits when a mother is separated from her infant child, or an employer undercuts American wages by hiring illegal workers. But this, too, is part of America's promise, the promise of a democracy where we can find the strength and grace to bridge divides and unite in common effort. I know there are those who dismiss such beliefs as happy talk. They claim that our insistence on something larger, something firmer and more honest in our public life is just a Trojan horse for higher taxes and the abandonment of traditional values. And that's to be expected, because if you don't have any fresh ideas, then you use stale tactics to scare voters. If you don't have a record to run on, then you paint your opponent as someone people should run from. You make a big election about small things. And you know what? It's worked before. Because it feeds into the cynicism we all have about government. When Washington doesn't work, all its promises seem empty. If your hopes have been dashed again and again, then it's best to stop hoping and settle for what you already know. I get it. I realize that I'm not the likeliest candidate for this office. I don't fit the typical pedigree, and I haven't spent my career in the halls of Washington. But I stand before you tonight because all across America, something is stirring. What the naysayers don't understand is that this election has never been about me. It's about you. It's about you.
That was then-Senator Barack Obama at the Democratic National Convention, August 28, 2008. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Michael LeBeau and Sarah Sweeney, produced with Brian DeShazer, from Barry McKay, and from Janet Mason. The Monotones, Randy Rainbow, and Aretha Franklin performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the Estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WPKN Bridgeport, Connecticut, KBRP Bisbee, Arizona, 4ZZZ Brisbane, Queensland, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The history of dispossessing people from their lands is long indeed. But under capitalism, especially as it emerged in England, a particular ideology sprang up to justify seizing the lands of others. That justification, whether applied to the English peasantry or the land of native peoples in colonial America, posited that the land could and should be taken if it were not being cultivated in the right way. And, my guest Gary Field shows, this is the same logic that was used to dispossess the Palestinians of their land in British Mandate Palestine and then with the establishment of the State of Israel, an argument he makes in his book, Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror, published by UC Press. Fields is Associate Professor of Communication at the University of California, San Diego, and joins me now. Gary, let me start by asking you about the term enclosure, the title of your book, and a key term for understanding the argument that you make. What does the term enclosure mean?
I use the term enclosure as kind of the overall theme of the book as a result of a chance encounter I had early in the research, Sasha. I went to interview the mayor of a town in the West Bank called Qalqilia. And the mayor of this town, who had been mayor for quite some time, told me a story about what had happened to Qalqilia in 2003. Now, this town gained some notoriety during the early days of the Second Intifada because Qalqilia had been completely surrounded by this wall, as Palestinians call it, a concrete wall. There was only a small little entryway in and out of the town. And what he told me about of what had happened after the construction had been completed, which took about 3 or 4 days, he said that all of the entire town was put under curfew. They could not go out of their houses. And when the townspeople came out after 4 days and they saw what had been done to them, they were shocked. And he used what this mayor, whose name was Maruf Zarhan, what he told me is he said, they have enclosed my city. Now, the word enclosed really resonated with me because I had actually done economic history as a minor field during my PhD. And the English enclosures were a phase of early modern history in England, which represented the prelude to the agricultural prelude to the Industrial Revolution. And what had happened in England was that the estate owners wanted to regain ownership of the common property on their estates that had been used by tenant farmers for centuries under English common law to graze their animals, to gather foodstuffs like berries, and to hunt small game. And the estate owners, beginning in the late 16th and early 17th century, began to take back that land with the help of Parliament. And what they did is they enclosed large areas of the English countryside and made those areas into private individual properties that was now off limits to their tenants. When the mayor of Qalqilia, Mayor Zarhan, used the term enclosed, I began to think of the situation in Palestine in sort of broadly historical terms, kind of like a phenomenon that had been ongoing beginning in England in terms of constructing exclusionary spaces on the landscape, places where people could and could not be. So I used... It was at that moment that I began to think of the situation in Palestine as historically analogous to something that had taken place centuries earlier during the English enclosure movement in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century. So I used the term enclosure as a way of drawing an historical analogy between Palestine and what had been happening earlier. And really, the idea was planted in my head by Mayor Zarhan of Qalqilia. And I began to work with that concept. And I began to think of the Palestinian situation as something that was not historically unique, but had actually echoed, had echoes of something that had taken place in the early modern past.
Well, let's talk more, and we'll certainly get to Palestine, but let's talk about that parallel, the parallel with the English enclosures when the common land was enclosed by the estate owners. When it happened, how was it justified?
It was justified on the basis of something called land improvement. And this was a discourse that had started to emerge in the 16th and 17th centuries in conjunction with the development of the profit-making system, the development of capitalism. And, of course, capitalism was the core idea of capitalism was making a profit, making the economy more rational and efficient. And so the idea of leaving land in as common land to be used as a common resource sort of did not resonate with the spirit, the emerging spirit of capitalism that was beginning to dominate the economic discourse of the time. So that it really the discourse that began to emerge as the justification was the discourse of improvement. And you see this in England beginning in the 16th and 17th century, that is this pervasive and really dominant idea about making land more productive. And the idea was that if you took land out of its common uses and turned them into private individual uses, that the land and the landscape would be more more efficient, more productively farmed, more intensively farmed. And that was really the justification for the estate owners going on the attack, using the political institution of Parliament to retake this common land on their estate in the interest of improving it for the health and welfare of the nation.
Well, you use the term technologies of force to describe the mechanisms that allow enclosure to take place. In the case of the enclosure in the English countryside, what technologies were used? You mentioned already Parliament, so there's obviously one component of it was legal. But tell us about the mechanisms that allowed this to take place.
One of the most important mechanisms that allowed this to take place, and that I talked about extensively in the book, was the mechanism of cartography. And it's no accident that mapping and capitalist development and even nationalism begin to emerge in conjunction with one another beginning in the late 16th century. What starts to happen is that cartography, and especially the mapping of estates, what the mapping of estates, and called estate mapping, what that begins to enable estate owners to do is that they begin to see their land not so much as bundles of rights that were written up in texts and bundles of rights that would be allocated to both landlord and tenant, but they began to see their estates in graphic form. And when they ordered these early mapmakers to begin to map their tenancies, they began to grasp much more completely how their land was either being used productively or unproductively. So in other words, what mapping did is it enabled and provided estate owners with what John Berger, the art historian, called a new way of seeing. Mapping gave estate owners a new way of seeing their land and tenancies, and they began to reimagine their estates as being redrawn with the tenancies removed and those areas kind of consolidated into much larger tenancies that could be farmed with wage labor. So that was one of the most important what I call technologies that enabled estate owners to see their estates in a new way. That was one technology. Another technology that they used equally, if not more intensively, was the technology of the law itself, in this case, property law. These estate owners used the law, appealed to Parliament, as a way of convincing parliamentarians and the nation that what they were doing was not just self-interested, that is, that this was not just for individual profitable gain, but this was something that would make the nation of England powerful again, because England was involved in rivalries with some of its colonial neighbors like France, the Netherlands, even Spain in the 16th century. They wanted to make England a powerful country. And the way you had to do that was to be able to mobilize the resources of the nation that could support colonial ventures. So you had to have a productive agricultural system. The justification was that if you consolidated the estates, created larger and larger farms that would be farmed by wage labor, agriculture would be more efficient, the nation would be more powerful.
And what was the fate of the dispossessed? You just talked about the creation of wage labor.
Yeah.
How did people survive at that point, and how radically were their livelihoods changed?
The English enclosures, according to many of the actual specialists in this area, the English enclosures was probably the most pervasive socioeconomic transformation of the early modern era, because it did a couple of things. First of all, it created these large consolidated farms in the countryside that would be farmed much more intensively. And so many of these tenants were either bought out by the estate owners themselves, or the tenancies were actually what they called ran out. These tenants were run off the estate and essentially turned out, much like somebody from a building today might turn out their tenants. And these tenants had nowhere to go. Many of them, sort of paradoxically or ironically, returned to their estates as wage earners. They were the ones who had farmed these estates for generations as tenants. They returned as wage earners, but of course not as many returned as had been there previously. That was one part of this. A second part of it, of course, and this is a very familiar story, is that many of these tenants were so-called freed up, as Karl Marx would say. They were freed up, and they became the early battalions of the industrial wage proletariat, who migrated into these newly emerging cities. Manchester, Birmingham come to mind, and they were the earliest of the new industrial proletarians that, of course, Engels talks about so vividly in The Condition of the Working Class in England. Most of them, of course, came from the English countryside, and they were dispossessed by the English enclosures.
Gary Fields is my guest. We're talking about his book, Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Gary, your book, Enclosure, looks at the plight of the Palestinians through the lens of the past, and you've just been discussing the enclosures in the English countryside starting in the 16th century. But then, starting in the early 17th century, something similar, you argue, took place in the New World, in colonial America, to do with the dispossession of the Native Americans. Tell us about that process, and how was it justified, and to what degree was the way that it was justified related to how it was justified in the colonial home country of England?
What happens in England's overseas colonies is, in a way, a mirror image of what happens in England itself. The process simply begins a century later. And really, if you want to focus on a figure who kind of spans both England and England's overseas territories, you can look at the figure of John Locke. Mm-hmm. Now, Locke is generally credited with sort of developing a theory of individual property rights on the basis of improving land, the same logic that I mentioned a little bit earlier. Locke didn't really develop that theory. It was already quite prevalent by the late 16th and early 17th century. But what Locke did is he synthesized the elements in the English common law that were evolving to develop a theory of property rights. He kind of synthesizes it by 1690 in his second treatise of government. But what Locke also uses the enclosures as a point of reference, but what Locke also represents is he was an official with the Carolina colony. And much of his theory about property rights is written in the fifth chapter of that second treatise. Much of his theory about the rights to landed property is written with the example of North America in mind. Because what the English colonists do is that they bring this logic of land improvement, the idea that one owns land because one puts their labor into improving the piece of ground where the land is located. They bring that same logic to North America, and they use that logic to make a couple of key arguments. They use that logic to claim, first of all, that the Native Americans did not farm their land intensively enough to claim a property right over that land. And what the English do is that they use the logic of individual rights to land that they had developed during the English enclosures that had entitled estate owners to take over common lands. They use that same logic to argue that Native Americans did not have property rights in the land that they hunted on or migrated from, or even at times cultivated, because they did not develop a sufficient level of agriculture that would anchor them to the ground in a way that the English planter was anchored. So that they used a similar logic to justify their takeover of Native American land. So what you see in the North American case is the English colonists using the logic of individual rights to land, individual property rights that they had developed during the English enclosures to justify the taking of Native American land. And even John Winthrop, the colonist from Massachusetts in 1630, suggested that the Native Americans had no cattle, they had no fixed housing, they did not cultivate crops in a sufficiently regular and intensive way. Therefore, what Winthrop said is, if we take the land, but if we leave them a little bit, nobody will be harmed in the process. And the English basically used that logic throughout the 17th and 18th century to progressively dispossess the Native Americans of their land.
What role did divine will, i.e. God, play in the justification of the dispossession of the Native Americans in North America?
It seems that God always has some role to play in these stories. God appears in Locke's chapter on individual rights to land, because what Locke does is he references God Almighty in suggesting that what God had intended humans to do was to subdue the earth in pursuit of their livelihood, and to subdue the earth in the most intensive way possible. And that's how he justified the estate owners taking control of large tracts of the English countryside, because presumably the estate owners would subdue the earth in a much more rational, efficient, and intensive way than individual small tenant farming would. Now, of course, if God had intended humans in England to subdue the earth, he also intended Englishmen to pursue that same mission as colonists. So that basically what English colonists added to this idea of subduing the earth that Locke had developed in that chapter 5 of the Second Treatise, God had intended humans to do is to subdue the earth. And therefore, the idea of English colonists subduing North America in the most intensive way was clearly what God had intended. So the English colonists also had a justification for their colonizing mission on the basis of what God had intended humans to do, both in England and in the New World.
What were the key mechanisms, technologies of force, to use the phrase that you use in the book, which mechanisms were crucial for the seizure of Native American land in North America?
Again, the mechanisms, what I try to argue in the book is that not only is the justification about improving land consistent throughout all three cases, but the technologies of force are also consistent in telling a common story about dispossession and the takeover of large parts of the landscape. What happens in North America is that English colonists begin to map North America in a particular ways. We tend to think of maps as mirror images of land and landscapes, but really what critical geography teaches us about maps is that maps are not just mirror images of landscapes, they are arguments about the lands. They are projections, not just reflections. And early English map makers of North America began to project their ideas about the English take about North America basically being English land. And this begins very early, and it begins actually with a couple of key maps, one of them by the explorer John Smith, who was also a very skilled cartographer. Smith's map of New England, for instance, uses a very, very tried and true technique of mapping to kind of project the idea of a piece of territory as being something imagined. When he maps New England in 1616, he maps it not as it is, not as he sees it, but basically as he imagines it, and that is as a part of England itself. He uses English names on his map. All of these places that he explored, he affixes English, what's called toponyms to that. Places like Cambridge, places like Sandwich, places that have very familiar English names, so that even the title of his map is called New England instead of the Native American name that it was known for at the time. It was certainly not. It was only New England in the eyes of New Englanders. So they use maps very effectively to project an image about this territory as belonging to England. And the sort of culmination of this really occurs in a map that's done by the early 19th century by this cartographer by the name of John Mellish, who kind of projects a territory that put sort of uninterrupted all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific without any mention or even presence of Native Americans on the map at all. So that the idea, the representation in the map is that this is a land completely English, under English control. They also, just like in England, they use the law very effectively. And what I argue in the book is that there are a couple of very key Supreme Court decisions connected with John Marshall that basically are absolutely critical in sort of as technologies of force. And the one that is really most notable is sort of first of all, the 1823 Johnson versus McIntosh decision. This is a Supreme Court decision that basically every law student is familiar with these days. And what Marshall's opinion in Johnson, and this is a decision in 1823, the decision was that Native Americans had never been owners of their land. They had always been simply tenants in North America. And so it basically removed any kind of notion of Native Americans as owners of the land that they used and which they hunted and where they farmed. So it basically changed the status of Native Americans from owners, and the colonists actually did treat them as owners at the outset because they couldn't simply remove the Indians. The balance of forces were such that they couldn't simply remove them until much later. And so they used the law finally to institutionalize the status of Native Americans essentially as tenants in North America. And that was a critical turning point in Indian removal, which occurs 7 years later under the President Andrew Jackson.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Gary Fields about his book, Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror. That book is published by UC Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Gary Fields is professor of communication at UC San Diego, and the book looks at the enclosure of Palestinian land by looking at past enclosures in England in the starting the 16th century and the Native Americans starting in the 17th century. Let's turn to the question of Palestine and the enclosure that took place and continues to take place there. In the late 19th century, Zionists in Europe set their sights on Palestine and started to migrate to it. How did early Zionists regard historic Palestine?
The early Zionist movement in the late 19th century was really motivated by nationalism that had kind of swept the European continent and other areas. And they were really inspired by nationalism and believed that the Jewish people deserved a territorial container of their own. Now, many of the early Zionists looked at Palestine as a logical choice, but surprisingly enough, not all the early Zionists were completely wedded to the idea that the Zionist movement should seek out some kind of national territorial container in historic Palestine. There were many other possibilities that they were looking at, including Argentina and Uganda. But historic Palestine did offer some advantages in terms of the Jewish people believed that they had some historical roots there and that they had some justification for considering that territory to be in some ways belonging to the Jewish people. So after Herzl publishes The Jewish State in 1896, the Zionist movement actually went through some debate about whether Palestine was really the best possible place to sort of conceive of this project of statehood, because many of the Zionists actually knew that Palestine was inhabited by an overwhelming majority of people who were non-Jewish. And so, at the initial Zionist congresses, they discussed other alternatives, including Uganda. But they finally settle on Palestine by the early 20th century. And they think of Palestine as one of the advantages they have there is that usually historical nationalist movements look at history as something that will be the historical inspiration for that movement, and the Zionists were no different. They considered Palestine to be something that was very close to their spirit and soul in terms of Jewish history. There was a continuous Jewish presence there. And so Herzl began to imagine and conceive of the Zionist project for state building as a project that would target Palestine for eventual construction of a Jewish state.
What, in this case, were the mechanisms that allowed this to happen? Obviously, there's the period leading up to the formation of the State of Israel and then after the State of Israel was founded.
The early Zionists had this idea initially that they could perhaps purchase their way to statehood. With the idea being that through sufficient numbers of immigrants, buying up a sufficient amount of land, that that could be the pathway to eventually creating a Jewish state. And so the early Jewish settlers, the early Zionist settlers to Palestine in the early 20th century, began to purchase tracts of land, mostly from absentee Palestinian landholders, who had Palestinian tenants, by the way. But the purchases in relative terms were quite small. I mean, the overall amount of land that the Zionists managed to purchase, even on the eve of statehood, was really, really very, very small. And so they began to imagine, the Zionist movement, sort of paradoxically enough, or not, maybe not paradoxically enough, emulated some of the same kinds of phenomena that we associate with the English enclosures and English colonization. They began to, for instance, draw maps of Palestine that projected this territory as a Hebrew national space. They appealed to British mandate, the British mandate authorities, who took over from the Ottoman authorities in 1917, to rename portions of Palestine using Hebrew names, and so they begin to put through all of these institutional mechanisms of a parallel state within the protectorate of the British Mandate, so that the British Mandate government from 1917 to 1948 actually sort of acts as a kind of protector of the Zionist movement, creating a set of parallel state institutions, like a state developing within a state. And so through mapping this territory, they also began to what the early Zionists do after they purchase some of these territories, by the way, is that they begin to evict some of the Palestinian tenants on these estates that had been tenants there for generations. And there develops pervasive enmity between some of the early Zionist colonists of land and some of the tenants that had been displaced in that process. So some of the – and, you know, all, of course, legal, so that the dispossessions that occur, the early dispossessions, are completely – they have a completely legal framework to them, but there's enormous enmity nonetheless.
So do you think there is a link between the ideas that were used to justify the enclosures in England starting the 16th century and then to the British colonies in North America starting in the 17th century to dispossess the Native Americans? And then, of course, you have a situation where, of course, the Zionists are motivated by their own ideologies, particular nationalist ideology of Zionism, but this is also taking place in British Mandate Palestine. Can one trace the transmission of a certain set of ideas from place to place, or is the logic more innate than that?
What I try to argue is I try to argue that there is a common set of themes in all three of these cases of dispossession. And there's a common ideology to all three cases that, and this ideology goes back to the English enclosures, suggesting that the improvement of land is sufficient justification for entitlement and ownership of that land. So that logic of land improvement plays out in all three cases, because what the Zionists suggest very early when they are when they begin to purchase land and they begin to colonize Palestine, is that they make references to the fact that the Palestinians who farmed that landscape had basically neglected that land and had not done what God had intended humans to do, which was to subdue the earth. So there's a common ideological justification running through all three of these cases. The Zionists also use this idea of land improvement as pervasively, if not more pervasively, than the English estate owners and the English colonists, because they are constantly making reference to the fact that Palestinians are undeserving as owners and stewards of Palestine, because they claim that they had left, or the Zionists claim rather, that the Palestinians had left as an essentially barren and neglected landscape. Now, Palestinians, of course, believed that the landscape that they had cultivated in terms of olive and fruit trees was just as bountiful as anything that the Zionists had done. But they simply cultivated in a different way. What I argue also in the book is that in each of these cases, the development of exclusion on the landscape is a common theme. That is, that there, in all three of these cases, whether it be English estate owners, English colonists, or Zionists, what they attempt to do, and they attempt to create a new system of exclusion on that land. And this system of exclusion elevates their status as the rightful and justifiable owner of that land based upon the fact that they believe themselves to be the most capable improvers of that land. So the Zionists use similar logic. They use similar tools, maps. They use the property law, and what I show in the book is that what they do in creating a Jewish landscape is that they are doing the same thing as estate owners do in creating a landscape of private property, and what English colonists do in creating a white landscape of white colonists. This theme, this is what enclosing land is about. It's about cordoning off a piece of land, creating a new system of exclusionary use on that space, and justifying that the creation of that exclusionary use and exclusionary system of ownership.
Gary Fields is my guest. We're talking about his book, Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you have discussed how in each of these cases, in the enclosure of the English countryside, in the dispossession of the Native Americans in colonial America, and then in Palestine, that those who are doing the dispossessing, before they transform the landscape itself, which they do, they transform the landscape of imagination by projecting onto yes. places the names, that kind of aspirational sense of what the place should be rather than what it is. And I wondered, what role do you think those ideas, that imaginative geography term that you take from Edward Said, what role does that play in this process? I mean, clearly, part of it is harnessing a justification that allows you to seize someone else's land, along with the sorts of institutions and mechanisms that are necessary. But to what degree is that aspirational or imaginative projection and justification also meant for the dispossessed side? Because clearly of the three, the dispossession of the Palestinians, particularly as it goes on into the 21st century or through the 21st century, is
a highly contested affair outside of the region, in fact, throughout the world.
What Edward Said taught all of us, including myself, is that process of colonization, the process of imperial takeover of someone else's land, it's not just a material phenomenon. He acknowledged that colonization is, in the first instance, something motivated by materialist impulses. He made a concession to Marx, of course, in doing that. But he said that the process is much more complicated, because what the colonist has to do is that the colonist has to go through a mental conversion. The colonist has to reimagine the land that they covet somehow, and to reimagine themselves as the rightful owners and stewards of the land that they are seeking. And Said used this in many of his works. I mean, it's a key element in Orientalism, key element in his thinking on colonialism. And his idea is what you term imaginative geography, that is, reimagining landscapes, was very influential to me in writing this book, because what I saw in all three cases is these groups with territorial ambitions all reimagining themselves as the rightful owners and stewards of the landscapes they coveted, and using similar kinds of justifications to explain why it was necessary, as well as desirable, for them to take possession of the landscapes that they were seeking. So I think this is, alongside the materialist impulse of simply wanting that land, I think this is a critical step in the whole process of taking possession of someone else's land. So, and indeed, this, and what I argue in the book is that this is a common theme in all three cases. All three of these groups with territorial ambitions, the estate owners, the colonists, and Zionists, all of them had some idea of why they were entitled to the land that they were seeking. And they all used a similar set of instruments to actually pry open those landscapes and to take them from groups already on the land. Now, ultimately, they used these kinds of subtle forms of coercion, and ultimately they are able to use more overt forms of force when necessary. The law, for instance, is a technology of force that's ultimately backed by what we call the police power of the state. And they, all three of these groups, ultimately do use overt forms of force in promoting their objectives. But they use these as a last resort, or as something that is extremely outside of the primary of the main contours of everyday life. I mean, the Zionists, of course, use a war in 1947-1949 to ultimately wrest control of the entire area of Israel, of today's Israel. But after they settle into Israel, they use very, very coercive, but in a sense subtle technologies to actually wrest control of all of the land that Palestinians had managed to hold on to after 1948, and they managed to secure that land as well. So they do this as a way of furthering their imagined vision of what that landscape is and what it should be.
Well, let me end by asking you how that vision of what the landscape should be from the dispossessor, how does that shape the way the dispossessed see the struggle over the landscape? Because although you're arguing that the creation of this imagined geography is very forcefully about justifying the process of dispossession and making that dispossession right and just. But clearly, for those who are dispossessed, they see it quite differently, and yet their vision may be shaped by that relentless projection of who should own the landscape, why historically it should belong to the dispossessors, why it would be justified for them to have it. Are there conclusions you can draw from how that has shaped how the Palestinians have reacted and understood and struggled over understanding their place in this landscape where they're being forced out?
Palestinians have their own imagined geography of this landscape, which is quite different from the imagined geography of the Zionists. They believe that they are equally, if not more, entitled to that land. And one thing that is different in the case, in the Palestinian case, is that we see, even after a long period of time here, Palestinians are still struggling despite overwhelming odds against them. They have a concept which they hold on to, an Arabic word called sumud. And this word sumud means steadfast. And the Palestinians, despite this extremely asymmetrical struggle in which they are waging, in which the balance of forces, the balance of power, is extraordinarily unequal, what is astonishing to me in all of the trips that I've taken there is that they are continuing to try and hold on to what they have, and they will not be pushed aside somewhere else. I think there's a farmer in a farming couple in the Palestinian West Bank town of Tulkarm, and the way they described it to me is that they said by planting crops, by farming, and they actually are this couple has actually become very famous in the West Bank as some of the most pioneering organic farmers in all of Palestine. They believe that by planting crops in this new way, by having establishing this kind of showcase kind of agriculture, by anchoring both themselves and their crops to the ground, that they are remaining sumud, steadfast to this small piece of territory that they are still holding on to. And I'm amazed at just how pervasive the thinking about sumud has been among Palestinians. They still continue to struggle. They still continue to believe that this land will once again that they will recover lands that they have lost, and that most of them believe that the land can be shared, that they can share this land just as much with the Zionists as any with any group, and which is also an astonishing thought. So they are not going to be moved easily, and they are not going to give up easily, and they are continuing to promote this idea that this land is as much theirs as it is of anybody else's.
Gary Fields, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Professor of Communication at UC San Diego, Gary Fields, about his book, Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror, that's published by UC Press. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song.
please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.